we're waiting for. Did she register as an attendee?
I have the panelist list. Yeah.
Yeah, let me check your.
Yeah, she was on the panelist list.
Yeah, she got an email.
Okay, all right. But she should be able to get in.
She said she's been on the call but hasn't been let in yet.
I see her.
Okay, she has been promoted up to a panelist, so she came in as an attendee.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. I see you guys now.
Morning, Lindsay. Welcome.
Morning. Thanks for having me back.
Are we up and running, Travis?
Thanks for being here.
ladies and gentlemen, we are broadcasting a recording. The chair is, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Ms. Leloy. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The time is exactly 9 o'clock on our Pacific coast, which is noontime where we are in the state of Maryland. And welcome to the second day session of the 98th public meeting of the D.A. Buchanan Independent Safety Committee. The first item of our agenda is for committee members' comments. Dr. Peterson and Dr. Butness, your comments, please.
No comments.
Dr. Butness?
No comment, thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. And then the next item on our agenda is for public comments on items that are not on our schedule agenda. So for any members of the public who wishes to address the committee on any matters of their choice, please come forward and raise your electronic hand so that the council's committee, Mr. Bob Rahi, can acknowledge and open your microphone.
All right, Mr. Chairman, I'm seeing no hands. We'll wait a couple of minutes here, or seconds. Anybody wants to raise a hand, this would be a good time. Seeing none, I think we can proceed.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Mr. Bob Rahi. The next item then would be information presentation requested by the committee of Pacific Gas and Light Company. And may I now then turn the podium over to Mr. Thomas Baldwin, the Director of Business Operations. Mr. Baldwin, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dr. Lamb. First up today, we have Mr. Shane Guess, who has been working with Pacific Gas and Electric for 18 years. He is currently a licensed senior reactor operator at Diablo Canyon. He has a Bachelor's of Science in Nuclear Engineering from UC Berkeley and has an MBA from the University of Laverne. He's currently with the Generation Business Planning Team, and he's going to summarize how our last year went in terms of our operating plan, as well as discussing the 2021 operating plan. Shane?
Thank you, Tom. Let me just do a quick sound check since this is my first time on video. Can everyone hear me with no feedback okay?
Yes, indeed.
Very okay. Good.
Yeah.
Perfect. Clear. All right. Well, thank you very much. Let me share my screen here, and I will be showing you my presentation on the generation operating plan for 2021. I hope you all can see that. So thanks. I'll just say good morning. Can someone just give me a check to see that they can see my presentation on screen?
Yes, it's right here.
Yes, indeed. Mr. Gass, it's
very clear. Thank you, Dr. Lamb. So good morning. Again, thank you very much for the opportunity to present to you the Generation Operating Plan for 2021. I know it's been about a year since I spoke to the DCISC, and I think it was last year right before the COVID-19 pandemic where I presented the 2020 Generation Operating Plan. So We'll fast forward to today. I'll review what we did over the year 2020 and then give you the operating elements of the plan for 2021 and beyond. So the one thing I'd like to start with.
Shane, I'd just like to say I'm really glad that you're back and appreciate having you presenting, and always good to see a UC Berkeley alum.
Oh, yes. Go Bears. Thanks, Dr. Peterson.
You're welcome. Good.
I'll just start with saying you probably ask yourself, what does the operating plan accomplish? What is it being used for? And my answer to that is the operating plan is our line of sight roadmap to providing safe, reliable, and affordable energy to our customers. And this plan for 2021 and beyond includes all three generation organizations. As you know, back in late 2019, we started to reorganize the generation organization into three distinct groups, and that's nuclear generation, power generation, and the business and technical services wing. Of course, I'll be focusing on the nuclear generation part of this for my presentation, but what we do is we start with PG&E's, the company's goals, and then we align generation's goals to those. And in doing so, we established eight major categories or focus areas for the 2021 operating plan.
You may I interrupt, Mr. Gass?
Oh, please.
For years, when we were informed about the operating plan, we, at least I, had been used to hear the two focus, which were safety and reliability. Now I heard a third emphasis, which is affordability. So in your presentation, would you please enlighten us about where would the affordability focus would come in on your plan?
Oh, absolutely. And you'll notice too, in the order that I said those three focuses, safety is number one, reliability number two, and affordability number three. We're never sacrificing safety for a competing goal of affordability. So I want to make that clear. But I will focus on affordability as I can going through the topics to explain how we're doing that, because it is really, this is a business and we need to be respectful of our customers and their needs as well. So we'll see one of our focus areas is customer. And that's one focus area where we do incorporate affordability efforts.
Great.
Shane, this is Bob Budnitz. You should know that historically, it was before I joined the committee, at the beginning, a principal rationale for the existence of this committee from the start was a concern that perhaps the company would allow financial considerations to impede the number one safety focus, which the public and the PUC thought was crucial. And this committee's having been established at that time was because of that concern.
Yes, indeed.
And of course, we've been in existence for 20 plus, more than a quarter century. And that has always been our focus right along, and it's fair enough.
Okay. Yep. Thank you for that, Dr. Budnitz. So I'll discuss these, like I said, in more detail, and I'll show how they all interrelate to between all the eight focus areas. So let me take you to the next slide. I want to first start with looking back at 2020 and just give you a high-level summary of what we did in 2020, what goals we achieved. You heard from my colleague Matt Coward, I believe yesterday, on the 1R22 refueling outage. So I believe he presented a table that showed we met all of the goals in safety, reliability, schedule, budget, and that was a great success. I'll cover some of the quantitative results in a second. One thing I do want to mention, because it's something I'm proud of, at least being with the company for 18 years, is our Nuclear Regulatory Commission performance results for Diablo Canyon were in the highest performance category yet again. That's column one, licensee response. And we had four violations last year. That is half of what it was the previous year and the lowest since 2016. And that's something we strive to keep up, but it's something that we're proud of as a station. It shows exemplary performance based on the views of our regulator and our compliance. One thing that we had to deal with last year, and I'm sure everyone has had to deal with this, is COVID-19 standards. So we established robust safety standards at the plant. That included, well, I remember too, speaking with our site vice president, that included a restriction on company travel, eventually mask standards. It included sanitizing workspaces. And one of the reasons that we're here, I'm at home right now presenting to you, is that we did a lot of remote work for those that could do so. And obviously not the entire workforce can at the power plant, but we've done really well at keeping case numbers really low at the plant. To this date, I do not believe we've had any workplace transmission. So that's something that was something we didn't plan for, obviously, but it's something where our nuclear rigor, I would say, helped us to establish the right standards, monitoring, and make sure that we're keeping our employees safe. And then finally, for 2020, you may know Kerry Harbor presented, our plant manager presented the Tier 1 retention end. That occurred in early September of last year, and that was marking the end of the four-year retention period, and we maintained a skilled and proficient workforce. Right now, we're in the process of monitoring for the next 3 years, which is the Tier 2 retention period, and making sure that we still keep up a skilled and proficient workforce and acting swiftly if we need to, if we see any signs of decline in some group's headcounts, or if there's qualification issues or such. So that's on the radar coming up in 2021 as well. So a lot of successes in 2020, despite being a pandemic year, I would say, and some other challenges of remote work. And I'd say we did really well in 2020 considering. I want to go into the measurable results now. I handpicked a few of these metrics to illustrate how we did in 2020. The first one you'll see is our DCPP reliability and safety indicator. That's a composite metric that takes into account various things, including unit capacity, generation capacity. It includes other topics such as industrial safety, radiological safety, and some other characteristics like nuclear fuel reliability and chemistry performance. We did not meet our goal for 2020. We came in just short of the goal. And most of that has to do with the generator vibration issues and taking the plant unit 2 offline for some time that we didn't plan on. So that's the reason for that 2.5% under goal for the reliability and safety indicator.
Now, may I ask you, how is that composite compiled? Is 100 indicate everything is fully satisfactory? Are there any weighting factor involved in compiling that safety indicator, Mr. Gass?
There are weighting indicators for each of the categories I mentioned, and I didn't cover all of them. I know there's a lot of other ones like safety system reliability and so forth, but 100% would be ideal, perfect in all of the areas. But there are some decrements to, the waiting for generation performance, for instance. And that's really what this deficit is attributable to.
So you assign a weighting factor to each and every one of the component?
Yes, there is a weighting factor. I don't have the details on how those are calculated, but there are weighting factors for each one.
Sure. Okay, thank you.
Yes, indeed. The other ones show that we met or exceeded the goal for all of the other areas that I pulled out of the operating plan for 2020. I won't elaborate on the outage radiation exposure because I know Matt Coward already covered that part of it, but we did reduce our goal because we were doing so well with dose performance. And we want to make sure that we always maintain a challenging goal. So we came in at 26.7 REM, which is great performance dose-wise for the outage. And if you look at all of the industrial safety metrics that I've put up here on the screen, our goal has always been first quartile. And we came in first quartile with margin in both, preventable motor vehicle incidents, lost workday cases, and any injury that results in a day away, a restricted work or transfer to another department. So we're proud of that. That speaks to some of the principles that we use for safety performance. And I'll remind you of those. I think I may have covered them last year, but we still maintain that all injuries are preventable. Leadership's responsible for preventing injuries. We plan safety into our work. and we look out for each other. And I really like the last one. I get into the field every now and then for outages and for other duty team responsibilities. And that's a really important one. I think that's the key to making sure that we keep our numbers low here and make sure that people go home safe at the end of the day. Regulatory findings. I mentioned no significant regulatory findings. We had none last year. We had four regulatory violations from the NRC. None of them were considered significant. And like I said, lowest number in the last few years. And I did mention already that we are in column one. So I just wanted to give you a snapshot of the more important ones that we strive for and shoot for. This is just a snapshot. If you look on your screen, I'm showing you the generation operating plan, and it is a published document. And this operating plan is distributed to the entire plant staff and the entire generation organization. So this is the cover page. Like I said, our line of sight to providing safe, reliable, and affordable energies to our customers. And it shows the line of sight because it has the PG&E mission, vision, and then our goals as they relate to the PG&E mission and vision. So I will, like I said, elaborate upon those in a second.
How could a member of the public get this?
It is in PDF format. I can work with Tom Baldwin after this and see if it's something we can distribute.
If you can distribute it, send it to Bob Rathy, and then we can put it on our website, and members of the public can find it on our website. I mean, we're not the best channel, but it's certainly a channel. And that would be beneficial.
Great. I'm taking a note of that, Dr. Budnitz, and we'll see if we can.
In past years, they were public documents. You know, it's just a question of how the distribution works.
Excellent. I'll make a note of that, and then I'll work with Hector. And I've got Bob Rathy's name written down as well. So this slide, I'm not going to spend too much time on it other than to let you see what PG&E's mission is. And I want to also show how we translate that into focuses, culture statements, and actions. So if there is, from among these eight focus areas that we've established, an action that someone can take or ask themselves on a day-to-day basis, that's how we have this laid out here. For instance, under people, am I holding myself and others accountable? For customer, am I operationally focused? And then, you know, the one that I like the most, safety, am I following all standards? That's an important one. There's a standard for pretty much every work item that we do at the plant. And this is a good guide. You might see these when you're coming into the plant on the access road too, as signposts. So we found that this has worked well for us, and we're continuing this in the 2021 operating plan as well. So that's our line of sight to generating excellence. So that was my quick review of 2020. I'm going to get into 2021 now, some key elements of the operating plan as it exists today for the future. And I'll start with the eight focus areas. I've alluded to them before, but I want to give you a graphical representation of them now. And you might be surprised to see, oh, there's a couple new ones on here from last year. For instance, the one that sticks out right away is wildfire mitigation. And I'll show you how nuclear can help with that and how it's done so already. Other ones that may be unfamiliar to you before this year, relentless execution. We've reworded some of them, commitments, risk-informed work and resource plan, and you'll see how we have strategic actions and goals for each one of these. All right, prior to that though, a question that I'm sure a lot of people have is, well, how do you accomplish the goals? How do you meet your mission statement? One important aspect of that is our leadership model at Diablo Canyon, and that's the engage, enable, sustain leadership model. You may have heard of this before, but I just want to cover a little bit about what does that mean, engage, enable, sustain. It's our model that we've used for at least a few years now, but it starts with engage. We want to make sure that we engage each employee by cultivating strong intrinsic motivation. And this is a loop, by the way. We want to enable our team to perform with excellence. And when I say that, what we say is it's one thing to want to perform well through that strong motivation, but it's a different challenge to be able to perform, to be capable of performing. So we want to enable the team to be successful. And you could translate that into processes, procedures, leadership, and so forth. And then finally, sustaining high levels of performance. Once the teams are engaged and motivated, enabled and capable, high levels of performance need to be sustained. We need to have a structured work environment, and we want to act swiftly and quickly if we see any performance decline or signs of gap to any standard. So that's what our leadership model has been, and it's been very successful for us. We can see a lot of that through our speak up, listen up, follow up culture. And I'll explain a little bit more about that when we get to our safety slide. But this is something that enables us to accomplish our mission. Some key work projects and initiatives for 2021. Of course, I'm going to emphasize safety first on all my slides, but the first thing is to maintain first quartile safety performance. We were able to do that last year, and it's our number one priority. That is the first bullet on every slide. We do have for this year one refueling outage that we plan for coming up. I'm sure my colleague Matt Coward mentioned that to you. That's the 22nd refueling of Unit 2. We did move that up to mid-March, so we'll be starting that outage at that time and having the unit up and at 100% power reliable before the summer months. We do have two refueling outages in 2022, so there's a lot of planning and preparation that goes into that. There's a lot of work when there's two refueling outages during a year. It's something that you know, some people look forward to, some people don't, because it is a lot of work, but just based on our fuel cycles, cycle lengths, it happens every now and then. So this is a year where we're planning and preparing for that. So we have a well-established outage preparation and milestone procedure that enables us to be successful in meeting all the milestones for those outages. I did mention this is the first year of the Tier 2 retention period for Diablo Canyon employees. That's important because this is the year where we may see more movement into, or actually out of Diablo Canyon. So we're really taking a close look at headcounts, the number of people that we need to be successful in the important departments, such as operations, security, maintenance, and so forth, and acting quickly if we need to arrest a performance decline or a headcount decline. Haven't seen any of that yet, but we do have our eyes on a few groups to make sure that they are fully staffed and able to perform as we'd expect them to and ensure success for our refueling outages and day-to-day operation and maintenance of the facility. Another thing that I'm not sure if you've been introduced to it too much, but our Pathways program, we're in phase two right now, which is building your pathway. What the Pathways program includes is making sure that the Diablo Canyon employees at the end of the facility operation know exactly what they want to do, where they're going to go, what skills and knowledge they might need. And we want to make sure that everyone is set up to the best of their ability and our ability to enable success. So there's different pathways that each employee may have. One could be retirement. One could be continuing on with decommissioning. One could be finding a position or career elsewhere within PG&E, or there could be other instances where people might want to stay in the nuclear industry and go elsewhere or go outside the industry and do something completely different. But the advantage that we have in this phase two period is that people should now be looking at, you know, what can we do right now to make sure that we're set up for success when Diablo Canyon closes? One example, my colleague Lindsay Miller is instrumental in helping us do this. She just set up last week a good program partnership with our local university, Cal Poly, where we may be able to take advantage soon, actually, of project management professional certifications. We may have some cybersecurity certifications coming up, but these things are really set up to help people get positioned for the best way that they can once Diablo Canyon closes. So I'm excited about this program, and I'm probably even going to take advantage of it if I can work it into my schedule. So that's something a lot of employees are excited about, and I hope that they do take advantage of it. There's been strong interest already.
Now, may I ask you,
oh, please.
This is excellent planning program on the Pathway program. Now, just based on the demographics, would you venture a guess as to maybe one quarter of the population would choose retirement, one quarter would choose to stay with decommissioning, and maybe another quarter wants to go elsewhere within the company or go outside? What does the demographics look like?
I can answer that qualitatively, but it's based on just my word of mouth that I've heard through colleagues. I don't have exact numbers, and I don't know if Lindsay's on. She might be able to help out on there if she knows. But we probably can look at the folks with the years of service that will be eligible for retirement when the plant closes and estimate how many people will take advantage of the retirement option or will want to retire.
Right.
But we do have numbers too, a little more specific about the needs for the decommissioning organization. Mm-hmm. I think there is a lot of interest there, but there may be more interest there than there are spots available. But you know, already we've seen some folks take an interest in power generation, a handful, that wing of generation, and then other different organizations within PG&E. So while I can't be too quantitative on the demographics, just word of mouth leads me to believe that there's a lot of people that will take advantage of pathways, and there's a lot of people that do want to continue on with PG&E. They prefer, in my estimation, is a lot of people prefer to stay local in the local community, but that's not always the case. There's some people that, you know, may want to venture up north to some of our other service territory. But right now I don't think we have really precise numbers for how many people will do this route or this route.
Oh, sure. Right. For planning purposes, as you said, you know, if half of the population within the group is eligible for retirement, then it would be much less pressure on the remainder of the group to look at employment inside or outside.
Oh yes, very much so. That makes sense. And actually, our workforce, there will be a sizable chunk that will retire after tier two, and maybe even, you know, in a couple of years after that. But there is a significant enough population that is not eligible for retirement at that point. I mean, myself included. I think I'm a good, test case here too. I'll have 23 years with the company at that point. So I'll definitely be looking for continued employment with PG&E. And I just know by, like I said, word of mouth, there's a lot of people in the same boat as I am.
Right. So that's really good planning. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for sharing with us. Yeah.
Sure. A couple of other key work projects or initiatives or just activities that we have planned for 2021. We have our Nuclear Regulatory Commission evaluated emergency planning exercise. That was postponed from last year due to the COVID-19 pandemic and the exemption that we received for that. So that's actually my emergency response team that's going to be playing in that exercise. So got that to look forward to. And then one other thing is our last initial operator license class. That is just concluding right now. And that is the last class that we plan to have at Diablo Canyon to make sure that we're successful in having a sufficiently staffed operations department with licensed operators until the end of the license operation period in 2025 or 2024 for the other unit.
Hey, Shane.
Sure.
Furman Wardell here. That evaluated exercise, have you got the dates for that?
I do have them. I don't have them handy right now, but they are in my calendar. I believe it's, well, I don't want to guess. I can email that to you if that works for you.
Yeah, or get the word back.
Isn't that the thing that's on October 15th or something like that?
That's what I'm thinking, but I was just looking for confirmation.
Don't take that literally, anybody, because it's memory, but I'll look it up.
Hey, Shane, perhaps you could get that back to Tom Baldwin or Hector, and they could tell us what it is during the meeting here.
Sure. I believe it's September 15th, but I will confirm that. I've got several drills on my calendar through the year, so I know it was in the fall at least.
Yeah,
but I'll get that back to Tom.
We were thinking the same date, but I'm just checking to be sure that is indeed right.
Berman, it's on your FFPM, but that's tentative, I suppose.
That's correct.
Yes, what I said about October wasn't right. It's September, 15th or something? Anyway, we'll learn.
Yeah, September 15th is what I have. We'll confirm that, though. I want to make sure, double check for you. So our last initial operator license class, that's quite an achievement. That'll free up some instructors in our operations training department. We do have backup plans, though. There are several people that maintain senior reactor operators licenses in case we do have the need to, or more attrition than we expect. For instance, I'm, like Tom Baldwin mentioned, I'm one of those folks that still maintains my license active as an emergency if needed. So
this is really quite an achievement. I believe at the early discussion we had during the joint proposal initiation, remember, this is several years back, one of the concern the committee had was, gee, what would happen to the facilities capability to recruit and retain talent. So your success in the operator class is really a very big pleasant surprise.
Yes, indeed. We do have 4 years left, and it's something we need to take a really close look at very frequently because mass departure, obviously it affects the manning of the facility, and we need the minimum number of licensed operators available. So that's something that if we had to, we could act to put on another license class, but it's not in the plans right now. And we do have, like I said, the surge capacity, but it's something I just want to emphasize. It's something we need to look at on a very frequent basis and even predict if we are going to fall below. But right now we don't expect that. And our numbers are as we expect, and our operations team is monitoring that.
How did you do it? Did you hand out a lot of bonuses?
No additional bonuses for the folks that are licensed operators, but they're all part of the tier two retention period. And that comes with the retention bonus. And that's been sufficient to keep the folks here, and it's a good deal for them. So what we need to do is just monitor and act swiftly if we see we're showing a decline.
Great. Thank you.
Sure. Finally, I'm going to just cover each of the focus areas briefly for the operating plan, starting with safety. I mentioned, I believe last year, it's been a while now, but I believe last year we talked about the safety standard of speak up, listen up, and follow up. That's something that I really, really like about PG&E's expectation. And that's, if there's an issue that you have, speak up, tell someone about it, your peers, your supervisor. It's the leadership's responsibility to listen up. And the most difficult, I think, in some cases, follow up. That's very important to me as a leader. It's very important to the Diablo Canyon leadership team as well. We want to make sure that no one has any hesitancy to speak up about something that's unsafe. And I think we do that very well. In fact, I'd venture to guess that nuclear is probably the leading organization within PG&E in that respect. One thing that we do have the advantage of too is some of these nuclear traits and culture that we have at Diablo Canyon, we always like the opportunity to share that with our other teams. So another thing I wanted to cover on this one is there's a leader in the field expectation as well. COVID-19 has made that a little more challenging, but not impossible. But we need leadership to engage each workforce. We have different avenues that we can do that in, whether it's the department leader, walking around in the field, seeing work in progress, asking questions, trying to eliminate barriers that their workers face. Or the other thing is we also have leaders such as myself on a duty team that's on call that helps the shift manager, helps the watch commander periodically when we're on call. So they get a really diverse team of people checking in on them. And I think it's led to great dialogue. Issues are brought up that wouldn't otherwise be possibly, and just, makes for a good sounding board. Also, incident review boards. If we do have a safety issue, we need to address it quickly. We need to have all the facts as quickly as possible and make sure that we take decisive action, get to the root cause of what's happened, and make sure that that doesn't happen again. So this is, these are all elements of our safety focus area and what we've been doing in 2020 and what to continue doing in 2021 and beyond. People. So people, we want to continue to foster safety culture through an engaged and active and involved workforce. I mentioned before, for nuclear anyway, Pathways program is a great way for us to make sure that we're engaging our workforce and making them feel that we care for them, which we do, and make sure that they're set up the best way that we can set them up. So we do that through the Pathways program, through our Generation People Committee. You may recall me speaking about the Nuclear People Committee. Now it's the Generation People Committee. And we want to leverage the entire generation team in making sure that we're monitoring, we're hearing, we're listening, and we're taking action to make sure that we have the best performance, we have the most engaged workers. And that's been a success for the past, I want to say at least two years now, when we rolled out the Nuclear People Committee, possibly three, almost 3 years. So that's been a great place where people can get together, talk about issues relevant to people. All right, moving into a couple of the other ones, customer. So I have here is the strategic action that you can see it's focused on proper planning, preparation, and execution to improve reliability. Reliability is ever so crucial now, and customers expect basically 100% of, from PG&E's perspective, 100% of expectation that they will have the lights on when they want them and so forth. This is, you know, in light of public safety power shutoffs, and it's something like, you know, Dr. Lam had mentioned earlier in the efforts of affordability, we're balancing safety, reliability, and never compromising on those, but also considering affordability as well.
So this customer is the electrical grid.
Yes, indeed. I mean, it's the,
That's all good. I just want to be sure I knew what it was.
Right. There's, it's not only that, there's internal and external customers, but PG&E's perspective, it's customers out there. They're the customers paying the bills and expecting the service. And there's roles generation can play in that. We, you know, make sure that we're affordable, we're reliable. Those two, integrate into the customer focus area. But we want to, at least a nuclear generation, we need to collaborate among all the departments to prevent critical and consequential equipment failures, to make sure that we are able to deliver and we're not, you know, the roadblock, because we put out a lot of megawatts and we need to make sure that the grid can receive them and customers expect that. Another thing,
But the customer's sensitivity to price of electricity is well known within the state of California. How does the price of electricity come into your consideration?
We do have goals for basically, you know, the dollars per megawatt that we generate and how much it costs. And we there's another focus area on budget. So we make sure that we plan and execute on budget. And we have thresholds and metrics for that, to make sure that we're aiming for the plan that we put together to make sure that we're within those targets, those established targets. So that they kind of go hand in hand with the budget aspect of it and the monitoring of the budget, both capital and expense throughout the year.
But isn't it primarily due to meeting the requirements of the Public Utilities Commission in terms of rate hearings other than the demand elasticity of electricity? Isn't it true that's what the current landscape is?
Yeah, that is my understanding. There is an authorized rate of return and we plan with the CPUC and they allow us that rate of return and what's included in scope and what's not. So there are different teams within PG&E that that work to present our general rate case, and that's ultimately approved by the state.
Oh, that's good to hear. Thanks.
Sure. Relentless. So, go ahead.
I just wanted to comment. This is Tom Baldwin. you don't see affordability under customer. It is truly focused on reliability. We do recognize that the unexpected equipment failures can challenge reliability and can therefore challenge the customer experience. And much more impactful to the public is the lights going off versus paying a slight premium on the cost. We are in competition with many other power generators, and the whole industry bids in to the CAISO on a daily basis to provide that energy. And so we do owe it to our customers to be reliable, but at the same time, recognize we have an obligation to live within the performance and cost that we've set forth in our general rate cases with the CPUC. And so that's ultimately what you see in one of the goals coming up with respect to financial performance. And Shane will talk to that when we get there.
Right. So so this is basically not exactly a free market, in which if you raise your cost of production too high, you will be priced out of the market. This is not the scenario here, right? Because you are entitled to a rate of return approved by the Public Utility Commission, which offer you a great deal of stability and protection, so to speak.
Correct, yes. And thanks, Tom, for the clarifying detail there.
A follow-up question on Tom's comment. Right now, they're having a horrible time in Texas with blackouts all over the place. The entire electricity system has collapsed, basically, except for, you know, essential loads and stuff. The South Texas plant had a unit trip off because of frozen feed water lines. And it's just chaos there. I don't know what the implications are for California, but are there going to be some efforts to go check what happened in Texas, including with STP, and look for potential issues that could also impact the plant, you know, the Diablo Canyon? I'm not sure if there's anything that would be directly similar, but there's a lot of extent of condition type of stuff where there's similarities between the Texas and the California situation. And we have looked at grid reliability simply because it can impact availability of alternate offsite electrical power and things of that nature.
So I'll take a crack at answering Dr. Peterson's question, and Tom, feel free to chime in too. I know I've been watching the news about this a lot too, because I was wondering, you know, it sounds like it's possibly design related due to the very low temperatures, below which some temperatures that wasn't part of the design basis for some equipment. But Dr. Peterson, I agree that there's probably an extended condition. I don't know that we've decided we're going to look at it, but I think it's something that we should take back to our plant management to ask them and see if that's an evaluation that we should do, as it looks like there could be maybe not low temperatures, but I know we do have a climate resiliency part of PG&E that's looking at, for instance, what could we do with respect to floods, heat waves, and that's all generated from the wildfire seasons. And that's something that we're looking at in the aggregate from a climate change resilience perspective. Is there anything else you want to add, Tom, on that one?
As a generation organization, we are sensitive. Shane just mentioned heat waves. That was something California experienced last year that did cause some power shortages. And as a result, the CPUC did issue directive to obtain additional sources of energy should such an event occur. And as a result, PG&E Generation is looking at our plans and our strategies for particularly the summer peak season, and really looking at our to move our plans. And so we have been assessing our opportunities there, shifting some of our plans with respect to maintenance or outages throughout our fleet to ensure that we will be there and available to provide reliable service to our customers during that peak season, so we don't experience power shortages and potential blackouts or customer shutoffs during that period as we go forward.
Yeah, I think, you know, because one of the this massive cold weather where we're pulling huge amounts of cold air down out of the Arctic all the way down to Texas, that comes from the progressive destabilization of the jet stream and the polar vortex. And of course, it's accompanied by the simultaneous ingestion of massive amounts of warm air up through Siberia, which accelerates the heating. And of course, we're starting to see substantial amounts of methane being emitted out of that region. I think we can expect that these kinds of severe weather events are going to come with increasing frequency, and it's difficult to project fully what all of the consequences are going to be, but the driving factor is carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and it's really disturbing to see these things starting to happen, because I think it shows that things are moving a lot more quickly than we had generally hoped would be the case in terms of some of these positive climate feedback mechanisms that are emerging and are going to be impacting us. And we'll just have to look at what that implies around electricity supply and reliability. And we've got the wildfire things starting up as well. So these will be challenges. It would be interesting if there are going to be some examination of what's happened in Texas, and also looking at the impact on the nuclear units for us to take a look at that also.
Well, there's definitely going to be, there you and I and Peter can predict that with 100% certainty. There's going to be a careful look at what the design basis was and whether there was a need to revisit that based on what happened in South Texas. By the way, for the public, South Texas Nuclear Generating Station is the name of a two-unit nuclear plant south of Houston, Texas. So people will know what the jargon means. And the South Texas plant, by the way, has been historically one of the best performing plants in the U.S. fleet, going back, you know, quite a long way. And fair enough, they're proud of it, and they ought to be, because they've done very well. But they just had this thing.
I think that's why PG&E stole Ed Halpin away from South Texas and brought him to be on. And he did a great job. Yeah, no. He's amazing. He's just amazing. I'm sort of sad that he's retired now, because he just did exactly the right things that needed to be done.
But because South Texas plant has been one that others have emulated and appropriately, and here they had this event. There's going to be something coming out of that very soon, because everybody needs to get the information as soon as everybody can about what went on there and why. And whether it has implications for all the other stations, or maybe this one, or who knows? We'll see.
Thanks for the comments, everyone. I mean, I do believe there is some extent of condition there that, like you said, Dr. Budnitz and others, that we need to look into.
We'll take a look into that too. We'll go ahead and capture this in the minutes so that it comes out as an action item.
Excellent. Thank you. I'll just take us quickly through the other ones. Relentless execution. This one is the goal for relentless execution is to leverage our safety culture and leadership, as you see on the screen, to ensure we're the utility our customers expect us to be. And to do that, we're taking advantage of, like, for instance, DCISC, any recommendations that you may have, our Nuclear Safety Oversight Committee, different parts of PG&E and power generation. We have similar, like a Dam Safety Advisory Board and a Fossil Safety Oversight Committee, but it's leveraging all of the external insights that we can get, and in addition, our quality verification department as well. So external safety oversight processes is a very important part of relentless execution. The one I want to mention, and I think we touched on this a little bit, wildfire mitigation. So you might ask yourself, how can we as nuclear generation impact PG&E's goals for mitigating wildfires? There's a couple of ways that I can think of, but I have here is the strategic action. We want to make sure that we resolve issues in a timely manner. That's part of it. The other part is we can leverage the nuclear experience in helping out the rest of the PG&E organization. And by that, when we have public safety power shutoffs, one example I can say, I even helped out me being a senior reactor operator manager in business planning, is that I helped man a community resource center in Santa Cruz back in 2019 when there was a public safety power shutoff. There's also been several rotations that we've had to different parts of PG&E to help them with their wildfire safety, including our vice president of power generation, Jan Nimick. He was helping out on that team for a while too. But it's really issue resolution is what we're focusing on here to meet PG&E's goal of effectively mitigating wildfires. And you know, their bigger goal, as you probably have heard in the areas that you live, perhaps, is the public safety power shutoff. So the bigger PG&E team can leverage the nuclear generation team for their expertise in a variety of areas.
Did you have a focus on replacing very old equipment in the wildfire mitigation? The reason I am talking about that is that had been numerous news articles in the Wall Street Journal in particular and the New York Times regarding very old equipment that should have been replaced a long time ago by PG&E. Now, this has nothing to do with D.A. Buchanan, but since you are helping the organization to mitigate, I'm just curious, are you making suggestions as to why don't we, PG&E, as an organization, go expeditiously replace this aging equipment? Like Wall Street Journal even gone as far as naming the location and the equipment number and the vintage of the equipment, which is like 100 years old, but the equipment useful life was 50 years. And of course, you know, the tree trimming issue has been raised by a United States district judge who had jurisdiction over earlier litigation involving PG&E. My question is, when you're helping them, are you informing the headquarters management about all these news article issues to be taken care of?
Right. So I wouldn't say so much doing that from the nuclear generation perspective, but what I can say is that the Electric Operations Organization has committed to ISO 55001 certification. And in part of doing that for asset management, there is a very deliberate process of prioritizing the work that needs to be done. And included in that is replacement of old or aging components. And they do have a focus on that in the Electric Operations Department. And we've come together as a team because, power generation, gas operations, electric operations, and information technology have all grouped together in order to achieve that ISO 55001 certification. So we want to do the right resource risk-informed work plans, as you'll see on this slide as well. Part of that is prioritizing what we need to do in the portfolios in electric, gas ops, power generation, and so forth. So that is an inherent, an important role in that process for doing the right work at the right time. So it is something that they are doing. But from the nuclear generation perspective, we've helped out on a case-by-case basis, but we're not we're not integrated into the electric operations organization permanently, or we don't advise them on that. Not to say that we couldn't, because we do have at the higher levels, VP levels, there is some discussion about asset management, for instance.
Sure, sure. You know, I believe your systematic, you know, effort in reliability management would be beneficial to headquarters. Yes,
indeed. Yeah, and for a bit, we did have a lot of input into the asset management foundation and how we were going to proceed, and having a PG&E a strategic asset management plan. So that's the standard for how we do asset management across the different organizations. And now we're more in the implementation phase of that. So that's the highest standard of making sure that we're doing the right work at the right time.
Thank you. Thank you.
That gets into the risk-informed work and resource plan. And that's really looking at risk. And that's another part of it too, Dr. Lam. It's looking at risk. What is the most or highest risk aspect or component in these different organizations, and making sure that we use risk evaluation methodologies for helping out there. I want to move to the last two focus areas, commitments. So I did tell you about regulatory findings that we had last year, and they were very low. That's in this category. That's something we want to keep up. Another strategic focus area, or strategic action for this focus area, is documenting areas for improvement in the corrective action program. That's something we've done consistently well in nuclear generation. And because, like I said, this is a generation operating plan, this is going to be applicable for power generation and our wing business and technical services as well. So that's where it starts, making sure that we act swiftly and take action for compliance in our commitments. Oh, I think I went a little bit too far there. Finally, financial stability. We want to complete the business and business unit work plan within budget. We establish goals, like I said, based on our GRC and our authorized budgets from the company. To be within 2% is our goal in both expense and capital. And that really goes back to, are we being the company our customers expect? I mean, they expect safety, they expect reliability, and they expect that we're going to work within our budgets. In this process, though, as we're looking at the risk-informed work plans, we're choosing the projects that we need to work on a priority basis, and then following through and monitoring budget performance. So there's a very, very mature process that we look at for our budget to make sure that we are responding appropriately when we need to. And if we need to make trade-offs, we will, but we have the work plan priority and commitments, and commitments are definitely included in that. Other affordability initiatives, we always ask ourselves, is there a better way to do something? And we've tried to make that intrinsic into our culture, where, you know, someone in my group could say, you know what, I think we could save costs doing this. So it's part of our culture now too. One other part of this one is supply chain strategies and volume incentive rebates. Another thing we can take advantage of to make sure that we're considering these things because we don't have an infinite checkbook, so to speak. So with that, I will just open it up to any additional questions you may have.
Dana, I have a question, a couple of questions. Taking the operating plan, and you saw employees wanting to be able to see all the way up from their work to this plan. What does an employee hold in his or her hand that connects their work to this operating plan?
So they have goals within the operating plan. I didn't show you all of it, but each person has that PDF file emailed to them, and there's elements from it in their site standards handbook, which, you know, you could see at the high level leadership model. The goals, however, there's goals for nuclear generation, power generation, and business and technical services within the operating plan. And there's that chart that I showed you earlier. See if I can get back to it. Right here, our line of sight to generating excellence, they have these my actions as well. So the specific goals you can find within the plan. There's a sheet that I didn't
1 o'clock.
There's a sheet that I didn't include in there, but it does show what nuclear generation, what our major goals and metrics, very specific metrics are. So they can look at that and see, you know, what's the, you know, plan for industrial safety for 2020? What's our goal? You know, what's our outage goals and so forth?
Second question. Looking through the documents we received on CERTREC in January, there was a document called the Station Excellence Action Plan.
Yes, indeed.
And we're going to be looking at that at our fact-finding meeting in March. Could you tell me what that document is, what it does in relation to your operating plan here?
Sure. It's and Tom, feel free to chime in if you have anything additional to add on this one. But that's making sure that we address any gaps that we have. We distribute that to different departments to, you know, we have a station operating plan, and then we have different departments, station excellence plan and different department excellence plans. And it's a way that we can highlight the issues where we might have gaps or we want to improve in an area, and then have very specific owners, actions, and due dates for reaching those goals. But there is a tie to the operating plan as well. The operating plan's a more high level, I'd say, in the hierarchy.
All right, that's good. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yeah, this is Bob Budnitz. I think this is a very fine exposition of the highest level. I don't want to use the word guidance, although it is guidance, the highest level policy stance of the company and of your Diablo Canyon management team. Good for you. I mean, it's great. But of course, if I was a member of the public that was skeptical, I'd say, yeah. But this doesn't tell me whether it's working. This only, and I'm not complaining, I'm just observing. This is only telling me and the rest of us that you have this there, that you use it, and that is, you say, a foundation document upon which the details are built. Indeed. I'm not complaining, just observing.
Oh yeah, this is one piece of the puzzle.
It's almost the highest level, if you know what I mean. And in fact, I can give you I'll give you a metaphor, although please don't take it seriously. It's not intended to be a joke, but it is definitely not applicable. I'll just describe something to you, okay? We have a constitution in the United States that embeds in it very, very high level important things that matter to a lot of us, like, you know, in the First Amendment, freedom of speech and that sort of thing, and all sorts of things there. And in our country, that has mostly worked real well. But I want to remind you of something that if you don't know, I'll tell you. Why don't you go read the Constitution, I think that's what it was called, that Lenin adopted in 1920 when the new Soviet Union was known. It has all those same words, okay? It has all those same words, and yet none of it came about. You know, there was no freedom of anything. So it tells you that a high-level document's important, but it's not sufficient. I didn't mean to use that as a metaphor here. Of course, this isn't anything like that. But it is an example about how sometimes the highest level can be there, but is never implemented properly. In fact, just the opposite. It can be a shield for not good stuff going on underneath, but they keep pointing to that and say, no, we got the, you can see. I'm not accusing you of that at all. In fact, the fundamental mission of the DCISC in the safety area has not been this, as important as it is, but to dig down and see how it's working. You know, that's what we do. That's what we're supposed to do. And that's what we're chartered to do. So this is great. And I'm pleased to it. And we saw it last year. And I'm very pleased to see that you're trying to keep it up to date in the sense that new issues come along and new insights about what you're doing have given you the rationale to change the emphasis here and there, because you need more emphasis on this, and you learn that as you go along. Good for you. But just to tell the public that for our committee, this as good as it is just the highest level document under which all the details are to be implemented by you and your colleagues, and that we're here, our charter is to review them. Just wanted to say that.
Thanks, Dr. Budnitz. Absolutely agree. Good analogy. And our operating rhythm requires us to monitor the progress and be accountable for this too. So thanks for that comment.
Yeah, by the way, I have a personal friend, to be unnamed, who served for some years on the board of directors of the company, you know, at the top of PG&E. And just informally, just watching somebody at that level trying to cope with a great big company like this with all the different, you know, all the different moving parts, it's really important that at that level, these documents like this are there and that they see that they're there and that they're working. But even them, those people have, like us, the obligation to get down into the details and see that it's actually being work, how it's working. Thanks. Nice work, just to tell you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions?
Committee members and our technical consultants, comments on Mr. Gass's outstanding presentation. Dr. Peterson? Our technical consultants?
Chair from the public.
Right. Okay. Right. Let us now entertain public comments on Mr. Gass's outstanding presentation. Committee's counsel?
Yes, I do have one hand raised, and belongs to Sherry Lewis. Sherry, you...
Rick?
Ms. Lewis?
Yeah, thank
Rick,
you.
I know.
Welcome.
I am a member of Mothers for Peace, San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. Dr. Budnitz, I really very much appreciate what you just pointed out, because whenever I see a table like that or a chart like that, I find it very irritating, because it says all the right things, but how do we know any of them are being followed? And what you pointed out was very good. It really helped me a lot, because it does show what's supposed to happen. And then as long as people take it seriously and follow through with it, then that's good. So I just wanted to, you know, when I first saw that chart, I just thought, oh God, yeah, this is just a list of high aspirations, but now they fit in better. And I see that. Thank you.
Thank you for your remark. Committee's counsel, do you see additional public remarks by raising an electronic hand?
Mr. Chairman, I do not at this time. Give it a few more seconds if anybody wants to raise a hand. And not seeing any raised, I don't believe there's any further public comment.
Thank you, Mr. Rahi. That being the case, thank you very much, Mr. Gass, for outstanding presentation.
Thank you, Dr. Lam, and the rest. Always a pleasure.
Okay. Mr. Bauman, may I now ask you to introduce another speaker of your organization?
Yes, sir. And if I can, let me just close out one action from that last discussion. As we had discussed yesterday, the NRC evaluated exercise is currently scheduled for Wednesday, September 15th, which, as we heard yesterday, is the day before Yom Kippur. So just to make sure we're all clear on when that is occurring. So I know some of you will be observing that, so appreciate that. So we now...
I think I'm the one.
Can we join in the observation, Dr. Bennis? We are allowed to join as well, right?
We will welcome you, although we obviously COVID remains a challenge before us that has... yet to be solved. We expect we should see significant improvement by September. Next up, we have Russ Prentice. And we did hear from Russ yesterday, but just to recap for those that are new today, Russ comes to us with a master's degree in mechanical engineering from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. He's been with PG&E since 2009, was licensed as a senior reactor operator at Diablo Canyon back in 2014. He's held several positions of leadership, including a shift manager and our nuclear instrumentation controls maintenance manager. And currently, he is the director of risk and compliance, overseeing regulatory and risk programs at Diablo Canyon and the rest of Generation since 2019. So Russ is going to talk to us today about the root cause on our auxiliary feed water system piping corrosion. Russ?
Welcome.
I see Russ is over in the attendees. Could we promote him to... There we go.
Yeah, I just moved him over.
Okay.
All right. Can you hear me okay now?
You're good.
Yes. Yes. Excellent. Yes.
All right. Thank you all. Appreciate the opportunity to come before you. And we'll say continue our discussion on the Unit 2 auxiliary feed water piping element that we started yesterday. I'm going to talk a little bit about the root cause, and really the goal for this presentation is to make sure that the members of the committee have a clear understanding for what we discovered during our root cause evaluation, what we identified, was the cause and the contributing organizational factors associated with this event, and what we have done to address this issue and what we're continuing to do. So with that, I think it's helpful to provide a background about what does the auxiliary feed water system do and why it's important. So the aux feed water system, we'll just refer to it as AFW. That system is a design class one safety related system that supplies an alternate source of feed water to the steam generators when normal feed water is unavailable during design basis accidents or transients. The design basis of the aux feed water system is to supply water to the steam generators to remove decay heat and other residual heat by delivering at least the minimum required flow rate to the steam generators at pressures corresponding to the lowest steam generator main steam safety at that point. So, big picture of the system, it's designed to put water inside the steam generators when the normal source of main feed water system is not available. So, if you go to the next slide. In how we perform the root cause analysis, it's very important that when we approach it, we have a very clear object, defect, and consequence. And really the goal of that as we go through our root cause process is to make sure that we are focusing our corrective actions on the right thing. So the object that we identified for this root cause was the Unit 2 AFW system piping on the elbow downstream of steam generator 22 AFW control valve. So this is on a common line that feeds both the steam generator 21 and 22 steam generators. The defect was an approximate 1/16 inch diameter hole in the piping, resulting in a calculated 3.9 GPM leak. And I've got a picture that'll illustrate that hole and what we discovered here shortly. And then finally, the consequence of this event was that we had two trains of aux feed water declared inoperable, and that was on July 24th of 2020. And in accordance with our technical specifications, the unit was in mode 3 at the time of the event, but we transitioned to mode 4 and then ended up going down and using, and that's in accordance with the technical specifications that we have.
Russ, you want to explain to the public what mode 3 and mode 4 are?
Yeah, I'm happy to. So mode
just
3
briefly.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So mode 3 is when the reactor coolant system is at greater than 350 degrees, but the reactor is not critical. And mode 4 is once again with the reactor not critical. We're at a temperature in the reactor coolant system of greater than 200 degrees. Let's go to the next slide.
Hey, Russ, back up one slide. Sorry, this is Rick McCorder.
Yeah.
I think you said this line fed two generators. I thought it was just one.
Yeah. So this this ended up impacting. Well, I should say it impacted two trains of Aux Feedwater. You're correct. It impacted two trains of Aux Feedwater, not two generators. You're correct. It was in the common line feeding from two Aux Feedwater pumps.
Right. Just two, steam generator 2-2, right?
That's correct, yes.
Okay, thank you. Just want to make sure I have it straight.
Yep. Let's go. So what we do here with the root cause evaluation process, and it's a very rigorous process in which we initiate a formal investigation that uses industry accepted analysis to determine the root cause of the problem. So really the goal here is to drive not only to the direct cause, but also looking at the organizational aspects and the procedural pieces and the process aspects that go into this. Let's go to the next slide. So just the summary of the event, on July 23rd, an individual operator was performing rounds. And once again, the unit was in mode 3 at this time and identified that there was water leaking out of insulation for the Aux Feedwater in the Aux Feedwater system. Maintenance proceeded to remove that insulation and determined that there was a hole, a through wall leak in the pipe. And at that time, Aux Feedwater water was in service, feeding the steam generators with the 10% steam dumps. And just for reference, you know, the pressure in that system at the time is, you know, approximately 1,000 PSI. And then based on the location and the magnitude of the leak, it did require declaring two trains of Aux Feedwater inoperable for the plant technical specifications. Let's go to the next slide. And so this is a picture of the leak. And then the next slide is a picture of the hole. So when the system was shut down and cleared, there was the approximately 1/16 inch diameter hole that was identified. And this is a picture after the corrosion, the external corrosion was removed. And so what we immediately did when this was identified, so in addition to declaring those two trains of Aux Feedwater inoperable in accordance with our technical specifications, we initiated an extent of condition to look at the other Unit 2 Aux Feedwater piping that was to determine if there was any other causes or leakage that we were able to observe there. And then we broadened that extent of condition scope using the same philosophy. So looking at the same defect, which is the corrosion, external corrosion on Aux Feedwater. And then we proceeded to walk down the Unit 1 outdoor piping to see if there was any leakage. Unit 1 is at 100% power at this time. And then we developed a three-phase extent of condition strategy for inspecting all of the Unit 2 Aux Feedwater system. So systematically going through removing insulation, looking at the under the insulation for that outdoor piping, identified that there was with the broader extent of condition, there was other piping that required some repair. So we initiated external repairs at 7 different locations where we identified corrosion, and then. After that, then we started planning a more detailed Unit 1 extent of condition based on the information that we were able to determine from the Unit 2 extent of condition based on potentially vulnerable locations. And then on July 31st, we exited the tech spec action and declared both trains of Aux Feedwater operable based on the repairs and the evaluation conducted by our engineering team that demonstrated that the system was able to perform its design function. So kind of talked about these immediate mitigating actions. You know, we did the walk downs and we had other areas of wall thinning. So we've got very clear criteria that we need to look at using ultrasonic methodology, non-destructive examination techniques to go through and identify the locations of the locations in depth of any pitting. And so that's what we use. And we have clear criteria for what repairs were required, and those were executed. Let's go to the next slide. So when we talk about the direct cause and the root cause, so the direct cause is what actually caused the issue physically. And what we identified was that there was damaged insulation on the cold aux feed water piping that allowed moisture and contaminants to penetrate the aluminum jacket of that insulation and then be absorbed by the calcium interior. So that is the actual insulation itself is a calcite insulation, and it absorbed water and held that water close to the piping. And that process is a process called corrosion under insulation. And that accelerated the localized external corrosion. So that was the direct cause of what was observed. When we go into the root cause, what we identified that there were previous operating experiences that came through in the 2009 and 2010 timeframe that gave Diablo Canyon, we'll say, the opportunity that was missed to identify and put the correct measures in place that would have prevented this from occurring. So that's really what we look at. So those industry learnings from that external operating experience did not incorporate what was needed to ensure that we had mitigating measures in place to prevent this event. Let's go to the next slide. So we've got the corrective actions to prevent recurrence. Those are known as CAPERs. So the first one is very important, and that is what we identified as we went through the root cause evaluation process is that back in 1984, there was a design change that was initiated on the aux feed water system before the units went into service. And that design change installed check valves so that the actual aux feed water piping, the temperature rating wasn't as high as what was initially designed. So that piping was initially designed with insulation due to the high temperatures that would potentially be seen by that piping. And with that design change implemented, that piping was no longer going to experience temperatures that required that insulation, but the insulation was not removed at that time when it could have been. So the key corrective action to prevent recurrence is to remove the insulation that is not needed. And that's actually already been implemented on Unit 1 after the latest Unit 1 refueling outage. The insulation for that outdoor piping has been removed, and we have it removed on Unit 2 as well for all the areas that we have performed our review. And we took the insulation off as part of our extended condition walkdowns, and we left it off, and we have a modification that we initiated to document and evaluate that insulation being removed.
So let me ask a question about this root cause. How deep you go for the root? Mm-hmm. So in the previous slide, you said that the root cause was mm-hmm. that there was experience that had you taken it into account would have led, this is not you, but people back then to have understood, or even a few years ago, to have understood this, but you didn't understand it. So then I could ask the next question, well, that's not the root cause, that's just a symptom. The root cause is, why did they miss that? Mm-hmm. Okay, that's the question, that's the next question you'd ask. And I'm not talking about missing it in 1985, although I could ask that question too, or whenever it was. Yeah. So I could ask it twice. Why did they miss it in 1985? Uh-huh. That's probably really hard to understand, but then why did they miss it 10 years ago?
So
those are different, the same question, but they're different answers because I'll bet you, Nicole, it's almost impossible for you to get to dig into what happened in the 80s, somebody that we don't even know, didn't account for the fact the pipe was not as hot as it was originally going to be. And hence the cooler made more condensation, there. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, have you or your colleagues understood the why? Why'd you miss it? And why'd you miss it only 10 years ago?
That's a really good question. And just background in the process. So as we go through and establish the root cause, our goal is to get to the lowest actionable level.
Yeah, I know. I know.
The lowest level at which point we could, reasonably initiate corrective actions to prevent recurrence. And as we went through, the asking the why process, when we got to the operating experience aspect, we identified that as the root cause. And really the basis for that was the level at which point we truly had an opportunity to go through and initiate corrective actions based on that experience for this corrosion under insulation. So that phenomenon of corrosion under insulation was, we'll say, a poorly understood phenomenon leading up to this event, and the susceptibility to it at Diablo Canyon was not fully understood. So we look back at, okay, well, what are the opportunities that we had to gain that knowledge, to identify the vulnerabilities at the station and then drive corrective actions? And when we looked at the operating experience that came in from Waterford and South Texas project in the 2009-2010 timeframe, we were actually able to go back and look at the evaluations that were performed in that process and identified that they did not identify aux feed water as a vulnerable system in which action needed to take.
Okay,
and at that point, we had that opportunity to go through and remove insulation, permanently if needed. We had the opportunity to implement, inspections, reviews, things of that nature to go through, and that could have prevented this from occurring.
Okay, so you've just explained something that's helpful. It's so something like this happened at Waterford. And by the way, for the public, the Waterford is another nuclear power station in the east. And it's not that the Diablo Canyon evaluators at the time missed that operating experience. It's just that they did review it, but didn't appreciate that it should apply to this particular aux feed pipe.
Yes.
Okay. So see, I'm trying to make a differentiation. If you had missed the whole Waterford thing entirely, then you'd have to ask another question about whether or not you're actually filing these things right, or, mm-hmm. or just let it go. But it wasn't that. It was something else. So the root cause is not missing that write up. It's that not interpreting that write up as applying to aux feed.
That's accurate.
Yeah. That distinction matters to me anyway. Go ahead.
Yeah, it does. And for your information, we did go back and looked at the 1980s, design change. We did go through that review process.
I bet you did, but it's really hard because it's so far ago. Right?
But it was, getting the interviews and those aspects that are key for gathering the facts was more challenging. But there, we were able to look at the documentation that was present, it clearly missed that there was an opportunity to remove that insulation at that time because it wasn't done. So
now, Mr. Prentice, may I follow up on Dr. Butner's inquiry? To put things in context, there are numerous safety systems and numerous components in those systems that you and your staff are actively monitoring, right? So Dr. Butner's inquiry of why did you not examine it, why did you miss it, it's certainly very meritorious. To put things in context, I mean, is it even if you had well-trained staff, could you possibly examine all operating experience? Is it something you hit and miss, or is it something that you had enough, I mean, sufficient staff manpower and expertise to examine every input on every component, on every safety system that's under your jurisdiction?
Peter, before he answers, I'll answer my understanding. We learned, and he'll correct me if I'm wrong, that every OE that comes in the door is looked at. Okay? OE meaning a document that describes it.
Right.
As opposed to, no, they only look at some of them. Now, some of them, of course, they're not applicable right away, you know.
Right, right, right. But
we're right about that, Russ?
Yes, that's accurate.
Right. But is it a cursory examination?
No. Sometimes it's cursory because it's, you know, it's a boiling water reactor and the system has nothing to do with Diablo Canyon. So they can dismiss. It's not cursory, but it's sufficient. Okay. But everything is looked at as I understand it. We've attended those meetings and been briefed about that over the last period. And I believe that's at least in place. It better be, right?
Yeah. So, and I can provide some help and some context for that. So if you look back, you know, in the 2009, 2010 timeframe, the operating experience process for items that came through, they came in, you know, from the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations into a single person who was designated to, you know, to do that initial review and then, you know, send it to the appropriate individuals. But that person doesn't necessarily have the expertise in all these areas that they're looking at when they're determining applicability. So the process now is, instead of having a single person that, you know, divvies these things out and makes that initial evaluation of saying, hey, is this even applicable to Diablo Canyon? Now we have people who have subject matter expertise, who know more, and can better make those determinations. So that's why our OE process or operating experience process has improved over time. And, you know, the next corrective action prevent recurrence here is we've actually modified that procedure and that process just to further emphasize and to reassure that, hey, these when these items come in, they get evaluated by the right individual. And that right individual may be multiple people, right? So it might be, you know, a condensate system engineer. It might be an aux feed water system engineer. There's various people that this operating experience evaluation may be directed. So we've ensured that is clearly indicated in the procedure. So that, you know, you get the right subject matter expertise and the focus for these things that come in, because this event demonstrates the importance of the operating experience program to inform the station of, you know, potential new failure modes or things of that nature, so that we can drive mitigating actions.
But how many people do you have in your organization to engage in these endeavors? Or do you have reasonable resources, or do you have just one individual or look at all the operating experience?
That's the key thing, is it's not just one person. Whereas initially we had one person who was doing that screening and the initial sorting and looking at the applicability. Right now that gets, that's sent to a broader group, people who have that subject matter expertise, who can make that initial cut of applicability. And then if it's determined to be applicable, then it goes over into and gets the additional evaluation based on, hey, you know, what's needed to address this or evaluate, or, you know, what are the actions needed to ensure that we don't have the same problem that's coming through in the operating experience.
Okay, so you can allocate more manpower when necessary and as appropriate. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Okay.
That's right.
Thank you.
So we've talked about the taper 5 there, which is complete. We've also revised the system engineering program procedure to add additional information regarding corrosion under installation. Because like I said, this was a, you know, the understanding of this phenomenon prior to this event was low. So this directly addresses that. And then, you know, similarly, we've revised the containment pipeway structure aging management procedure to add the additional information on, you know, what piping is vulnerable. So we make sure that we get the right focus in those areas. Let's go to the next slide. So the other corrective actions here is revising our design change process to look at material compatibility and corrosion under installation as a potential failure mode. But it's important as we go through and, you know, modify the facility and make changes that we take that, that we've got flags in place to trigger us to look at those items. And then another important piece is ensuring that we've got training in place. And this goes back to the knowledge of corrosion under installation and those vulnerabilities and having that understanding for the engineering personnel who are performing the civil, you know, piping walkdowns and things of that nature. So they know what to look for. They know what systems are vulnerable. And we have the process in place and the knowledge in place to make sure that that issues are identified to avoid this occurring again. And then the corrective actions, we've got, you know, looking back at the operating experience, you know, those evaluations were insufficient. And there were some, we'll say, unvalidated assumptions in the process of those evaluations. So we applied accountability to the individuals who were involved in those initial evaluations. And next slide. And then it's important for our extent of condition corrective actions here. So we've actually completed the number of the unit one elements in the last refueling outage. And then we've got our unit two refueling outage coming up in which we're going to be able to complete this. And really what we're doing is looking more broadly at other systems that have potential vulnerabilities, basically colder insulated piping areas. And this includes a steam generator blowdown, feed water reg valve bypass piping, which, you know, doesn't normally have flow through it, and then the main feed water drain piping. So those are other areas that we identify as part of our extent of condition, that areas that we will need to, you know, take off insulation, look, and ensure that we don't have problems in those areas. And next slide. So when we look at the extent of condition or extent of cause, rather, so these are the actions that we're taking. And, you know, similarly, you're looking at, you know, various systems, looking for corrosion, performing inspections, and then also revising our material condition housekeeping procedures to clearly call out the insulation damage and degradation and making sure those get into the corrective action program or in our work management process so that we resolve that, because it's really an important piece of this. It's not necessarily just, you know, insulated piping that's cold. It's cold insulated piping where you have damage and basically areas for moisture to get into the calcite. So we flag that in our housekeeping procedure as well as something to look for. Next slide. And, you know, so what I hope that I've conveyed is, you know, an understanding of what occurred, what are the corrective actions that we've taken, and, you know, what you can see is the amount of focus and energy that we applied to this event to make sure that it doesn't occur again, as this is a very important for us as a station, that when these items come up, that we learn from them and we drive corrective actions to make sure that we don't have the same event or similar events occur in the future. Any questions for me?
Yeah, I just said, this is Bob Budnitz again. Go back one slide where you had the scope of what you're going to be doing soon. I closed my eyes and tried to think of what would be within scope, and I'm surprised, but you'll tell me maybe I got it wrong, that the piping near the pressurizer power operator relief valve area wouldn't be on that list because it's probably cold some of the time. Although maybe it's hot enough of the time that it just never gets a chance to get to get the corrosion going. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a key piece of this is when the temperatures are high, then any moisture that gets entrained, even if the insulation is damaged, any moisture will evaporate off and won't result in corrosion. So what we looked at is, you know, within a given temperature profile, these were the areas that we identified as areas we wanted to inspect.
Russ, this is Rick with a question. I know in the discussions we had and in the cause analysis, it talks about this area tended to be wetted more for various reasons than other areas, similar areas. One of those reasons was the steam generator relief, power operator relief valves. The drains tended to flow down through this area and perhaps cause it to be more wet than other areas. How much of a role did that play?
Yeah, and it's interesting because what you point out is correct, and that there are there's actually different these areas between unit one and unit two aren't that far apart, but the areas and the wind patterns and the environment is different enough where you see different corrosion rates and different susceptibility, we'll say. And having the local, we'll say, local moisture due to the 10%, you know, the power operated relief valves, the 10% steam dumps going off for having those emitting moisture into the air for an extended duration of time and having that moisture collect in that area certainly did was a contributor. It was very difficult for us to go through and evaluate the magnitude of the difference that contributed to, because then you also have to look at the insulation and the state of the insulation. There's a number of factors, but what I'll say is the local environment does play a factor, and we recognize that through our cost evaluation.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions for me?
Very good. I don't have any additional questions.
All right. I'll turn it back to you, Tom.
Let's ask the public if they have any comment.
Yes, indeed. Dr. Butness, committee counsel, do you see any public comment requests on your computer screen?
I do not, Mr. Chairman, at this time see any hands raised.
Oh, there is one.
There's not.
There one that just came up. Panelists.
Tom Murray.
Yes. Okay. And there is, Mr. Murray should be able to address remarks.
Good morning. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed.
Great. Russ, I've been attending the safety committee, not all the time. But in my recent memory, there's been a variety of things that have happened to the plant, starting with corrosion around a circuit board that controlled the raising and lowering of control rods. I forget which unit that was in, but then going to a generator that has a phantom vibration that can't be found, so they've had to jerry-rig some weights around it to try and get rid of it, and so that the they'll be able to run it at full capacity, hopefully. We noticed that the representative from the CPUC was here yesterday, and she was just checking on everything to make sure that she could get full capacity out of it in summertime. And then this seemingly small issue where you have a red iron drain get corroded and spring a leak. You know, this plant isn't brand new. You're the risk manager, and there's a lot that's going to be happening to it in the next 5 years before it's closed. Do you have any comments?
Yes. You know, the comment that I would provide there is, you know, when events occur at the station, you know, we take them seriously. And, you know, I think this, the root cause evaluation that was performed on this top speed water system is a good example of that. And that really we desire, and as the director of risk and compliance, my goal is to make sure that we perform thorough evaluations on these items to make sure that we completely understand not just the cause, but okay, well, what is the, you know, if there's an extent of condition, where else do we need to look and apply a high level of rigor to make sure that we understand and we can take mitigating measures to address the risk. And, you know, I feel that, you know, this root cause evaluation is a good example of that. Similarly, the process that we're going through with the Unit 2 generator and making sure that we understand these items. And that is very important to me. And we have multiple processes in place to look at items that come into our corrective action program to make sure that we're driving issues to resolution and we're managing risk and then monitoring the mitigation for those activities. And we've had numerous avenues to do it, both, you know, with internal and external oversight. So that would be my comment. You know, really what I would say at a high level is it's very important for us to learn from everything that comes through and to make sure that we're driving mitigating measures to reduce risk overall for the station.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Murray, for those comments. And I see no other hands raised at this time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Rahi. There being no additional public comments, let me say thank you to our speaker for an outstanding and informative presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, there is one more presentation by the committee's technical consultant before the end of the morning session. Dr. Bunness, Dr. Peterson, what is the preference about taking a break or should we just move on?
We take a break until the top of the hour. It's about a dozen minutes. What do you think?
Yes.
Okay, great. Then let us take a break until...
Mr. Chairman, before we take a break, I just want to let the committee and the public know that earlier this morning, I did receive an email from Dr. Justin Cochran with the California Energy Commission. And Dr. Cochran let me know that he is juggling quite a few tasks at the moment, but he is listening to our meeting as it goes along. As he described it, he's dealing with cascading impacts from winter storms. However, he did express his that he appreciated the value of the questions and the focus that the committee was bringing to these subjects and topics. He also mentioned, relative to Dr. Peterson's comment earlier on the situation in the Texas after these storms, that Dr. Cocker mentioned it's just not the electric grid that's collapsing, but also natural gas and petroleum is also having issues. And many of these issues are spreading downstream. So I just wanted to convey that and thank him for those comments. He is, as you all know, he frequently attends our meetings in person and via Zoom, but did confirm that he is listening in today.
I'm confident he's really busy. This has been quite a week, I have to say, if you take a look at what's been happening across the country.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Rahi, for the very useful information. Thank you. So we shall take a break and reconvene in 10 minutes, gentlemen.
Very good.
11 o'clock. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Might not have time to say it when the meeting's over, so I wanted to say it now.
Pleasure as always. Thank you for your frequent interaction and giving us something to challenge us. Well, just rescheduling folks at the last minute can be hectic.
We didn't have the opportunity to make a change to one of the agenda titles, and I regret that. Now, we have that 10-day publication notice, which in the San Luis Obispo Tribune actually requires us to get the notice to them 3 days before. So it's almost like a two-week publication notice in the print media.
Well, appreciate that perspective. We will keep that in mind. So build that into our future plans. Thank you.
Yeah, apparently we have to tell them what agenda items are going to be noticed so that the public can know what agenda items we're covering. We can change the order of the presentations, but we can't add a new item.
Got it.
Yeah. The Bagley-Keene Act is a little more, I'll say, unforgiving than the Brown Act, which our local agencies are under, but the state law is a bit different. And of course, it's going to be interesting to see after everybody gets used to Zoom, what changes there might be once we go back to whatever's going to be normal.
If it was safe,
we're ready to start, Mr. Chairman. It's three after.
Yep.
Yes, indeed. Gentlemen and ladies and gentlemen, are we ready? Mr. Loy, are we ready? When we wait for your signal.
Hi, this is Travis with AGP Video. We are broadcasting and recording.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Travis. Let us now resume the second day of the 98th public meeting of the Diego Canon Independent Safety Committee. The item on our agenda will be for the committee's technical consultant's presentation on a subject matter that the committee had deemed to be important. So, Mr. Furman Wardell, if you are ready, would you please make your presentation to the committee?
Thank you, Dr. Lamb. I am ready, and I'm waiting for my slides to appear. Who's in charge of slides today?
That would be Shane. And so,
yes, indeed, I will be getting it up right here. One moment. All right, let me know if you can see the slides.
Yes, we can.
Excellent.
Thank you. Gentlemen, ladies, I'm presenting the report of the fact-finding report here on December 14 and 15 that Dr. Per Peterson and I attended. And Shane, if you go to the next slide, I want to apologize for not wearing a tie today, but with some shoulder surgery and arms in a sling, it was not feasible to get a tie on. But had I worn a tie, this is the one I would have worn.
Actually, I told you yesterday you should have painted one on. Or have Joanna paint one on, but he didn't bite.
So hopefully the next meeting we have out there on location, I'll I'll bring my red tie. So, Shane, the next slide, please. Here's the list of agenda items for the flag founding meeting. And I'm not going to read each one of those right now, but I've got a slide to cover each of those topics. I'll leave it up for just a few minutes, seconds, so you can look at the subjects that we covered. You'll see a lot of familiar ones there. So let's try to Shane the next slide. The first thing we looked at was the refueling outage 1R22. Two items there. One was the foreign material exclusion, or otherwise known as FME, and the COVID experience. And I don't think I need to identify that acronym, I hope. The outage took place from October 4th to November 11th, fairly typical outage for the station. The COVID performance was good. They have a COVID prevention program, which we looked at. In addition, they have an COVID outage response coordinator. And between those two things, they had quite a successful outage. There were no new cases amongst PG&E personnel. There were roughly 800, maybe a little bit less, contractor personnel on site. And they had two initial cases tested before they actually got to work, and they put them in quarantine. Then during the outage, they had one case that popped up. So that's pretty good performance considering the number of people on site and the amount of work being done. It's pretty remarkable that they were able to get that good of performance. So my hat's off to them for that. FME, or foreign material exclusion, and basically what that is during the outage, there are a lot of components that are opened up. For example, a valve cover may be taken off a valve to work on the internals, or a tank may be opened. The reactor vessel head is opened and moved off so they can get the fuel in and out. And while that's the case, there's potential for things to be dropped in there. Tools, trash, dirt, safety glasses, you don't know. So they take extra precautions by using orange indicators, orange covers, and procedural aspects to keep foreign objects from entering these various components. And the results are they have level 1 through, I think, 4 or 5 violation levels. These are not NRC violations. These are just called FME violations. No level 1 or 2, and those are the most serious, most significant. They did have 9 level 3 or lowers. And, you know, while that's not perfect performance, it's darn good because with all the open items that they have and all the work going on, it's darn near impossible to keep things out of every open item. So the level 3 or lower are fairly insignificant, but I'm sure they put those in the corrective action program and are taking actions to be sure those don't happen again. That's the standard procedure at Diablo Canyon. All right, Shane, the next slide, please. We looked at a program that we look at periodically every couple of years, which is the motor and air operated valve testing programs. And a lot of the valves out there, well, there's many manual valves at the station, but these are valves that are operated either by the electric motors or by air operators. There are also hydraulic operated valves, but those are covered under the air operated program. And these programs basically periodically stroke test the valves during outages when the valves aren't needed for operation to assure that they have the right operability. And there are 1,900 of these valves in the station tested by maintenance. And they fall in categories, as you can see, 1, 2, 3, and 4. Category 1 really consists of only 6 valves. That'll be 3 pressurizer power operated relief valves on each pressurizer. So there'll be 3 per unit or 6 valves. Those are the highest category, the most significant valves in the station. Category 2 are the other related safety-related valves. 3 are typically are valves that are not safety-related but are important for reliability and operations, and 4 will be all other valves, which are of less consequence. The valves are tested by automatic test machines. They're rigged on the valves, and the machine goes through its cycle, operates the valve, typically open and closed, or closed and open, as the case may be, and records valve opening time, force needed to open the valve, stem travel, that sort of thing. During the outage, there were 43 air-operated and 23 motor-operated valves tested successfully. the programs themselves are both in green health, which is good. Next slide. We looked at something called electronic work packages, or EWPs. This is something we looked at a couple of times before. All work at Diablo and all nuclear plants is done in accordance with work packages or procedures. These include drawings, equipment manuals, procedures, checklists, other things that you would need to perform testing or maintenance or construction. Everything is done by procedure or work package. The industry itself is moving from paper to electronic work packages, some at different speeds. Diablo right now has been looking into it. And they're at about 2% of the work being done is done by electronic work packages. And at one time they had a goal of 50%, but they've since backed off of that because, I'll get to that in a second. But the work packages at Diablo Canyon, the electronic ones are used for fairly simple work, painting, insulation, scaffolding, building and removal, and testing and whatnot. So the bottom line here is Diablo Canyon is proceeding very slowly to electronic work packages mostly because of the closeness of the plant shutdown in 2025. And the reason for that is this is quite a change for the workers, the planners who have to plan the work and the workers who have to carry out the work with these packages. It's a fairly significant change for them. And rather than make this big change, particularly on significant or complex work, they felt like they didn't want to have to deal with that change in light of the only a few more years to operate. The next slide shows a tablet that would be one that the worker planner would plan on and a worker would use. It's a rugged tablet can be taken out in the field. And the next page shows a typical screen you might see. And you can't read that, but this is actually a notification that describes work being done and probably describes some settings. Right, now the next slide. As we do in just about all of our fact-finding meetings, we like to meet with the NRC, either senior resident or resident, typically the senior resident. In this case, we met with the new one, Don Krause, and I won't go over his education and qualifications. Rick McCorder did that yesterday in a good way, very complete. The things we talked about with Don were the outage 1R22, which we heard about yesterday from Matt Coward, very successful outage. The Unit 2 forced outages, which we're hearing about because of the generator hydrogen leak. I'm curious about what access NRC had to data for Diablo Canyon, what information, that sort of thing. And they pretty much have total access, as most any Diablo employee does. The NRC, as is the Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee, is concerned about the safety culture as the end of generation ends. They have a good safety culture, and we expect it to stay that way, but we're monitoring that as people leave and as people are perhaps worried about where they may go next or that kind of thing. Another item we looked at is one of our favorites, at least it's one of Perry Peterson's favorites, is workplace seismic safety. And that's the case where not only are you worried about the equipment operating through or during or following an earthquake, but you're worried about the people, about them getting hurt, or they're getting blocked from doing the jobs they need to do to perform their duties. In this case, it's not equipment we're looking at so much as it is the personnel. And we've noticed tall bookcases and other furniture and other things, books up high, that had the potential to fall during a seismic event and hurt someone. So Diablo Canyon they have a procedure for this policy where they have secured items that could potentially fall on employees. And we look at this to be sure they've done a complete job, like securing bookcases to walls properly and that sort of thing.
Furman, they also are concerned with an earthquake impeding access to various things. Something falls down and then you can't get something else. Right?
Yeah, I thought I just said that. But yeah, correct.
I didn't. If you did, I missed it, and I plead guilty.
Well, we both got it covered, so that's better than not covering it.
But that turns out to be easier to slip by than a bookcase right next to somebody that's sitting there all the time working.
That's right. The other thing along those lines, which has been around for a long time, Bob, is lighting for those passageways that people need to get through after a seismic event. Mm-hmm. So they have special lighting that has to stay on. Bottom line is our meetings with the NRC inspectors, we think are very beneficial. And it seems like they get something out of it too, compare notes with us and whatnot.
Furman?
Shane, the next slide, please.
Could we go back just a sec? I'd just like to add that the NRC access to DCPP data, I compliment PG&E for issuing PG&E laptops to the NRC resident inspectors so that they can log into the PG&E information systems from their homes. And that includes the capability to observe what's the state of the plant, the indications that are available in the control room, but to do that from home. And we actually have had anecdotes, senior residents telling us about calling the control room from home to question a certain indication that they've observed when they are looking at the information that's available for them remotely now from the PG&E laptops. This is just a tremendous thing, a direction to be going. This ability for the inspectors to be able to monitor the plant status no matter where they are, particularly given the pandemic. But I would point out that not every utility has done this, and that this also shows a substantial level of transparency that PG&E maintains with its regulators. And I would say the same. We've observed the same thing. That is, when we want to find information about the plant, or when there's something that we want to look at, the plant staff have just been proactive in making information available and guiding us to resources. And overall, this kind of transparency I think is really valuable. And this specific example of issuing the laptops to the resident inspectors is I think really good practice, and hopefully the rest of the industry will follow suit and do the similar sort of thing.
Good, thank you, Pierre. Speaking of workplace seismic safety, we did look at one item, and we were asking about the control room procedure cart. In the control room, there's a cart with wheels you push around, and it's got all the procedures, particularly abnormal and emergency procedures, contained in it, and it's used by the operators when a procedure applies. Well, we were concerned what happened to that control cart. One, from a standpoint of, would it hurt some equipment at the control panels or an operator, or would it dump the procedures such that the operators couldn't get their hands on the ones they needed? So, we did find, they gave us a copy of analysis that they performed back in 2010. So they were way ahead of us on this one. And the cart, the bottom line is, the cart will move some, but it probably won't damage any important equipment because everything else is much up, actually much higher than the cart is. And the most likely, the paper procedures will remain in the cart, although there could be some scenarios where probability scenarios where it tipped, but more than likely the cart would not hurt anything or people, and the procedures would be intact for the operators to use.
Is this analysis credible?
Yes. If you I copied it and pasted it in my fact-finding report, so it was available for you to read. Should have seen it in that report.
For sure, that these carts can tip over in an earthquake, but they're not going to hit anything or cause any damage. And they have additional sets of these procedures that they have access to. So it would not affect their ability to respond following the earthquake. So But the carts definitely are a bit top heavy and could tip over. There's not a major consequence if they do.
Right. That I am persuaded. But the last bullet saying the paper will remain in cart. How did that come about?
Oh, that's maybe not precisely the way to word it. It won't necessarily remain in the cart. They do expect that it could get spread across the floor.
Right.
I think. Is that correct, Furman?
Well, the way I portrayed that when I talked about that last bullet was most likely the paper would remain in the cart. I didn't have that word on here, but there's some scenarios where it's possible that the cart could tip over. I thought I covered that. But.
Frankly, if it was me and I was spilling something like that, I know for sure the paper would scatter everywhere. But other people are more fortunate than I am oftentimes.
So. Right.
Well, if it wasn't a conflict of interest, I'd ask for a contract to design one that won't do that. But I would charge them a lot
for it. Good news about the paper.
Okay.
The good news about the paper, the procedures are bound in notebooks. Sure. So, you know, even if it tipped over, they'd probably still be in the notebooks, more likely.
Okay.
All right, so I'm going to move to the next slide unless you'd like to have more discussion here. Okay, now here's an issue we've been following for a couple of years. Operations equipment status control issue. Operations has a procedure called plant status control, and this assures a proper equipment configuration in the station from a number of standpoints. One, our valves, for example, closed or open as per the drawings and procedures. Another might be, are there any problems with components sticking out electronic instrumentation that one might bump as one walked by or was out working in the area that might cause a piece of equipment to start or stop or change configuration. So this is to protect against those sorts of things. Back in 2019, operations discovered that there were some problems, some issues, some events where equipment configuration issues were identified. These, in this case, were mostly bump issues, if I recall. And they didn't work on it quite as vigorously, perhaps, as they should have. And the issue was escalated, I think, by quality verification in late 2019, and this led to yellow operations performance, which is not desirable. Operations, in response, developed their plant status control action plan, which we reviewed at our last fact finding on this subject. Action plan looked like it was appropriate, but they hadn't finished completing it yet. So the reason we went back this time to look at it was they had finished the actions. They were complete, and the effectiveness review was also complete and was positive. What I mean by that is once they complete the actions, they typically wait 6 months or so and do what's called an effectiveness review of corrective actions to see if they were indeed correct or effective. In this case, they were determined to be it was a positive outcome, and they were effective, determined. And the performance now as measured is currently satisfactory. So we were happy with this item being closed, and I recommend we close it on our open items list. I think I already did that yesterday. Okay, so moving on. As we do in each of our fact-finding meetings, we'd like to meet with an officer or director at Diablo Canyon. This time we met with Jim Welch, Senior Vice President and Chief Nuclear Officer. And we discuss typically fact-finding items that go down the agenda and other areas of interest. And Per, any comment from you on the meeting with Jim? Per Peterson, any comments?
Sorry, I was muted. No comments.
Okay.
It was a good meeting, very beneficial.
It's a good meeting. They're always good meetings, so we'll be continuing those in the future. Moving on, Shane. Another item we look at periodically is something called the safety security interface. And then another item here is the intake structure devitalization. I just put those both on the same slide. The safety security interface program is one that handles the effects of security changes on nuclear safety and vice versa. In other words, if security makes a change in the plant, putting up a barrier or a door or something security-wise, what is its effect on nuclear safety? In other words, does it impede operators from getting where they need to go, or does it impede adversely affect equipment in some way? So each security change modification goes through a checklist, and this is one item on the checklist. Same for modifications in the plant or procedure changes from operations or maintenance. That is, are the changes they're making affecting security in a bad way? So they have a checklist, which are completed before they turn the modification or procedure change loose. That's what that second bullet's talking about. Their standard DCPP review item is standard in the plant and procedure change procedures. This is something we look at regularly, generally probably every couple of years. And as in the past, we found the program effective this time as well, and with no issues. We look next at the intake structure devitalization. Now, what does that mean? The intake structure down by the water, where the water is brought in from the ocean, for condenser cooling, big concrete structure down there, also houses and watertight chambers the auxiliary saltwater pumps, which are safety-related pumps. And those are considered vital security items, and they're kept, and that makes the whole intake structure, or made it originally, a vital security area, which means you had locked doors, security guards down there. You had to search trains to get through, just like you did for the main plant, basically. Well, recent analysis showed that there are other pumps available to the function that the AFSW pumps would have had. Therefore, Diablo Canyon decided we'll devitalize the intake structure. It'll save a lot of security personnel, a lot of hassle getting in out of the intake structure. And so they went through an analysis to do that, as much of the industry has done, and sent that to the NRC for review and approval. And that has been approved by NRC. And the declassification, I believe, now is complete. All right, Shane, next slide. Okay, we look typically at systems or equipment each fact-finding meeting. I talk to the component or system engineer and see how the system's operating and what the health of the system is. In this case, we looked at the turbine generator health. The turbine generators, two components, large components, convert thermal energy to mechanical energy and then to electrical, or in other words, nuclear heat is converted to steam in the steam generators, which provides steam to the turbine for rotation, which then drives the generator for electricity. The turbine is a Siemens Westinghouse high-pressure turbine, which is mounted on the same shaft to three Alstom low-pressure turbines. So I'll show you a picture of what that looks like in a minute. Big, long device. Each reactor puts out 3,411 megawatts thermal, and that goes electric, converted to 1118 and 1138 electric for unit one and two, is slightly different at a speed of 1800 shaft speed. Turbine generator health for unit one, both are green and great health. Unit two, turbine's green, but as we know, the generators had the hydrogen leak problems, and therefore its health is considered red until that problem is solved. Next page, I'll show you some photos. To the left is a photo of the unit one turbine generator, and you've got the turbines there in the background. You've got the generator there more or less in the middle, and on this end, our end, is an exciter, which is used to excite the generator to produce electricity. If you would open those things up on the right, you'd see something like this. That's not Diablo Canyon's, but it's basically similar to what they have. Pretty complex, impressive piece of gear. And its health, like I say, unit one health is green, unit two turbine's green, but the generator is red. Moving on, Shane, please. We finally met with Maureen Zawalek. And Maureen was the Hector Garcia of the world back in the days when we were there. And she was our liaison between us and the plant. And she handled Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee, as well as the Nuclear Safety Oversight Committee and other things too. So anyway, she's now a vice president of generation business and tech services. And here are some of the her functional areas. And you can see what they got there. Some technical, some more business oriented. And you'll see Tom Baldwin on that list. If you put his name on there, he would be on that list. Tom, would you be the business planning guy?
That's right.
Okay. And as you can see, she's got the decommissioning. So she's her group of decommissioning has a lot coming up in the future for quite a long time. And I believe that concludes my report. There's one more slide, Shane. Oh, sorry about that phone. So this is just a slide of the list of items that we just talked about. So, Mr. Chairman and members, that concludes the report on this particular fact-finding meeting. Perry, unless you have some comments you'd like to make. Hearing none.
Herman, very good job.
Thank you.
I don't have a lot more to add.
The only thing I'd say at this point would be that it was a good fact-finding meeting, except it would have been a lot better had we been on site, as we've been saying through the time.
Furman, can you go back one slide to the meeting with Maureen Zawali?
I'm sure Shane can.
Yeah.
Here you go.
Were any of these topics of particular, anything interesting that you learned that you need to convey, anything?
We didn't jump into any particular one, Bob. I'd say decommissioning was probably the one of most interest to us. And you and I believe we're going to look at nuclear fuel in March at our March fact-finding.
Yeah, we're going to do that in just a few weeks.
But no, nothing particular there. Other comments or questions from the committee? Mr. Chairman, that concludes the report, and I'll be happy to answer any further questions. And I would ask that the committee accept, not approve, but accept the report.
Thank you, Mr. Waddell. Any additional comments from the committee's bench, from Dr. Peterson, Dr. Butners, or our technical consultant, Mr. MacArthur?
I have a procedural question. If you go to the last slide, which shows, you know, the whole scope of your thing. That's it. You had three meetings. You met with the senior resident inspector. You met with Jim Welch. You met with Maureen Zawali. Did both of you meet with all three of those together?
Yes, we did. Yes.
Okay. But sometimes only one of us would be meeting with some one of them. And okay, simple enough.
Yeah, Perry and I met together with all of these 10 items. Yeah.
You know, Dr. Butness, I believe that is at the choice and discretion of the committee member. You know, so whatever, you know, the committee members' choices will be followed. Yeah.
Well, I don't mind telling the public, I have never, in all these years, met with any of those people without the consultant with me. That's my practice.
Yeah.
I mean, we all have different practices. It's okay.
Right. Okay. Now, since we have no additional comment from the committee's bench, let us entertain public comments. Committee's counsel, Mr. Rahi.
Yes, I have one hand raised, and that is Mr. David Wiseman. And Mr. Wiseman, I believe.
Good morning.
Floor is yours.
Good morning, David Wiseman, Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility. I'd just like to go back a bit to what Mr. Wardell said in his report, that a bit of good news is that the NRC inspector, resident inspectors, were given PG&E-issued computers so they can have direct access to, I guess, monitor directly what the functions are in that control room, or I'm assuming surveillance, whether it's visual cameras or actually get into the desktops, so to speak, of the gauges and the dials, and perhaps he can collaborate. But my question is, that's all well and good, and I guess PG&E has their computers secured in a way. But if these NRC resident inspectors are working from home in residential San Luis Obispo, just as I am today, are they then using the computers to hook into PG&E or Diablo Canyon via the same Charter Communications internet high-speed modem line that I'm using now? Or are they operating on some sort of satellite-based secure communication, given the vulnerability of nuclear controls to outside influences that encodes and encrypts it in such a way they can be guaranteed there is no hacking, since they are working from home, on that line? Thank you.
That's an excellent question.
It's my understanding that they are granted the same access as PG&E employees who might take their computers home and are subject to the same security that the PG&E employees would have to follow.
That's correct. This information goes out through essentially data diodes. So there's no way for control signals to go back again. One can get into more detail, but then you start to run into safeguards type of information. Perhaps could one of our PG&E representatives perhaps provide a little bit more background on what types of information one can access about plant conditions if you're a plant employee?
This is Shane Guest. I'd be happy to elaborate on that a little bit. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Yes.
So I'll just clarify, there's no plant controls that can be manipulated remotely through the firewall that we have at the power plant. And we have cybersecurity standards as such. So the types of information that would be accessible to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission would be our corrective action program system. They'd be plant logs, but nothing that would be able to control or see even on a camera anywhere, our security systems or anything like that. So it's really plant information, that you can view read-only. There's no control that even me as a PG&E employee and senior reactor operator can access remotely.
Well, great. So Mr. Guest, are you informing Mr. Weissman and the committee that there's no security risk because of the firewall?
Yes, that is correct. No, there's no way to manipulate controls at the plant remotely.
Yeah, so there are really two parts of this. First of all information is going one way out. And if you want to communicate back in, there's a different system. Presumably they have email and that's all either, it doesn't have to be secure or whatever. But the second thing is certain information that is available inside shouldn't be sent out anyway, because if it could be intercepted by an adversary. And so that information, as I recall, is excluded from communication out. Like, for example, just the obvious thing is, surveillance cameras and stuff like that. That information is strictly never sent out to anybody. Is great. That right?
That's absolutely correct.
I remember we had a briefing about that a while back.
Yeah, I think this is the key thing is that the access is to the business type of systems that PG&E has. And I believe it's generally done through VPN, so it's a secure connection. But those systems don't connect to or have the capability to do anything in terms of control. But there's certain information from the reactor that gets sent over so that people can monitor how many megawatts it's making and other things about the plant status from the business systems. But there's not a reverse flow of information back that could by which one could control the plant. I think that's
well said, Dr. Peterson. That's exactly right. If I wanted to log in to view the status of the temperatures or pressures or any other megawatts, anything on the business side of the network would be available, and that includes email, corrective action program documents.
The way I remembered it was when the categories of equipment were being decided on what should be available to be sent out and what shouldn't. The supposition was, let's pretend that an adversary, an adversary got control of this equipment, of this information. Would that be a security compromise? And if the answer was no, out it went. It was available. And if the answer was yes, then it wasn't. So that was the, as I remember, the criterion used about what is and what is not to be sent out through that channel.
The committee, hello? Committee, David Weissman.
Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. That's my question. Thank you. So I guess then in answer to my question, and you've given a detailed description of what does and doesn't happen, the problem I have then was when Mr. Wardell describes the oversight of the resident inspector, the implication was they can see or they were able to monitor what is happening in the control room. My idea was literally as if they were a check pilot in the cockpit having that view.
No.
In the control room. He says, I imagine that the NRC resident inspector, based on his description, could say, hey, that operator over there hasn't noticed that gauge has just climbed a little bit. I wonder what's going on. That's the implication that's given when you say they have that ability to monitor what's going on in the control room. But as you've corrected and explained, no, they can monitor the same nuclear reactor functions that other PG&E operators or departments can monitor. I think it was a matter of the terminology he used in describing, without the limitations, what the actual monitoring therefore consists of. So thank you for clarifying that.
Thank you. That is very much correct. And it is an important point of clarification.
So they're not standing over the shoulder of an operator there remotely, so to speak.
They like to go in and do that in person. Generally the resident inspectors are trying to get into the plant on a pretty frequent basis, but this ability on the off hours and also with the pandemic to get access to this information about the plant, the plant operating conditions has actually, based on the discussion with the residents, been very helpful for them. So they're not to observe what's happening in the control room. Of course, they have full plant access privileges, and they go as they please any place. And that's all. I think that it's typical for the resident to go to the control room at least once every time that they're on site.
All right. Well, fine. Thank you for clarifying that. It's just I was imagining, you know, even on a public transit bus, they now have cameras over the driver, right, that can see both for security reasons, but whether he's or she is speeding or not. In other words, that's transmitted remotely, obviously, to the headquarters of the transit district. So that was the words he used suggested that was the type of overseeing that was going on. And I'm glad you've corrected that for me. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Weissman, for your remark. Now, with that comments, Dr. Peterson and Mr. Wardell, do you think it would be necessary to revisit the fact-finding report to make sure that this interpretation would not be extrapolated from the report? Is it necessary? I'm just asking.
Well, the report has one bullet in it, and that was on the slide. If we back up to the slide, the meeting with NRC.
Oh, okay. So by reading your report, one would not have the same impression.
You look at the third bullet here.
Mr. Weissman.
Is the third bullet. Now, That's all I reported. Now, Dr. Peterson jumped in and talked about the laptops that the NRC had. So he was adding and, you know,
embellishing. Yes.
And but the report itself only has this one bullet.
Right. So one would not be misled by the third bullet at all, right?
I don't think so.
Right, which is correctly stated and is factual.
Yes.
Okay. Great. Okay. That being the case, thank you, gentlemen. And let's entertain additional public comments. Mr. Rahi?
I'm looking now, Mr. Chairman. Yes. Well, I still have Mr. Weissman's hand raised. Not sure if he has another comment. No, his hand is down. I see no other hands raised at this time.
Peter, I wish to make a motion that the committee accept this fact-finding report And if the motion passes, then it will become part of our public record and go into our annual.
Yes, indeed. Is there a second motion?
I can second.
Mr. Rahi, would you conduct a roll call, please?
Will do. Dr. Budnitz?
Aye.
Dr. Lamb?
Aye.
And Dr. Peterson?
Aye.
Motion passes.
Unanimously. So the report is approved and accepted. And now we can move forward to the next item on our agenda.
Shane, thank you for the expert job of for doing my slides. I appreciate it.
Not a problem.
So the next item, gentlemen, would be adjournment for lunch. So shall we reconvene at exactly 1:30 p.m.?
Very well.
So we ought to ask AGP, should we log off and log back in or leave it on, or does it matter?
Feel free to just stay online here. You can just turn off your microphones, turn off your cameras, but you do not have to log out.
Very well. Thanks, everyone. See everyone at 1:30.
Okay, see you. Right.
I have 129. Berman, thank you for that email you sent me this morning. I have a response. I'm sort of kicking around here, having some fun with it.
Okay, good. It's 429 here.
I'll tell you one thing I was going to say, though, and I won't put it in my email. Any ship's carpenter could build you a cart that wouldn't spill the the operating plans all over the control room floor.
Yeah, but they wouldn't charge as much as I would charge.
That's true. And it wouldn't be Duke to qualify it or anything else.
I told you it's a conflict of interest, but if some ship's carpenter built it, the DCIC would want to review it.
Exactly. I can remember one of the first trips I ever made. I was at the purser's office, which faced aft, and the key where all the passenger room keys were in little, like a pigeonhole thing on my right side. I remember we took a roll and the keys started falling out of the pigeonholes. I thought to myself, what if this thing's ever rolled this far?
All right, folks, this is Travis Harms with AGP Video. We are broadcasting and recording.
Thank you, Travis.
Okay, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, the time is 1:30. The second day afternoon session of the 98th public meeting of the Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee is now reconvened. The first item on our agenda is for committee members' comments. Dr. Butness and Dr. Peterson, any comments?
No comments.
There being no committee members' comment, the next item is for public comments on items not on the committee's agenda. Any member of the public may choose to speak in front of the committee on any item of their choice. Committee Counsel, Mr. Bob Rahi, do you see any electronic hands raised?
Mr. Chairman, I do not at this time, but I would mention that Ms. Rochelle Becker, the Executive Director for the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility, did send us an email during the break. I sent it around to all the members. It had a link to an article that concerned PG&E, but it was not pertinent to the Diablo Canyon power plant, had to do with one of the wildfire events. So I just wanted to enter that in the record.
Sure.
Well, except that things having to do with PG&E and its safety culture are broadly applicable.
I understand. I do have a hand for Mr. Wiseman.
We all understand that.
Yeah. I have a hand for Mr. Wiseman. I'll go ahead and David.
Yeah, good afternoon. Before you could say anything, Dr. Budnitz chimed in on that. And I would point out, yes, the article was broadly indicative of PG&E's safety culture and specifically made the allusion to the concept of cost, spending money, and the need for safety, which were issues that Dr. Budnitz reminded this audience earlier today were part of the founding principles for the Diablo Canyon Safety Committee. That is to say, would shortcuts ever be taken at the expense of cost? And as the article points out, the twice bankrupt convicted corporate felon PG&E has indeed done that. So as Dr. Budnitz said, broadly applicable, it does apply. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weissman, for your remarks. Mr. Rahi, do we, or for that matter, committee members, should we respond to Mr. Weissman's remark, Dr. Benes? Dr. Benes, would you reply to Dr. Weissman's
remark? Yeah, it's in my inbox, but I haven't read it yet. Okay. I just looked at it.
I see no other hands.
So, Mr. Rahi, did you say you saw no hands?
I see no other hands, sir.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Rahi. There being no additional public comments, let us go to the next item on our agenda, which will be information presentation requested by the committee of PG&E. May I now ask Mr. Tom Barvin, Director of Business Operation of PG&E, to introduce the next speaker. Mr. Barman, please.
Dr. Lamb, we're going to be hearing from Pat Nugent, and I do see a number on the attendees that looks like his ending in 075, so I believe we want to promote him so we can hear from him. But Pat Nugent is the Director of Engineering at Diablo Canyon. He's been with PG&E for 30 years now. He started back in 1990. He's a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. He shortly thereafter completed a certification as a shift technical advisor, in other words, a control room technical consultant, and then progressed to a variety of leadership roles within engineering and regulatory. So he ran our regulatory services department for a number of years, interacting with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and also spent some time with the industry, the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations, assessing other plants' performance and really getting a broad view of the industry and what good looks like. He was our Fukushima response manager earlier in the 2010s or the 2010s decade, and also has served some time as leading our quality verification department. So, Pat, can you hear me now and get your mic on?
I can hear you, Tom. Can you hear me?
We can. So, Shane will drive the slides for us, and I'll let you take it away.
Okay. Thank you, Tom. As Tom mentioned, my name is Pat Nugent. I'm the Director of Engineering Services at Diablo Canyon. I've been in that role for about 3.5 years at this time. And I'll be talking about the recent engineering organizational changes and provide you an overview of our engineering excellence plan. Next slide, please, Shane. So this slide provides an overview. This slide provides an overview of the current engineering organization. As the director, I have 5 direct reports, and the engineering organization consists of 4 separate sections. Those sections include strategic engineering, tactical engineering, program engineering, and design engineering. And then I've got one individual who is the assistant engineering director, who's responsible for a number of different functions, everything from oversight of engineering's application of the corrective action program to various other special projects, including work with our Unit 2 generator.
Next slide. Pat, this is Rick McCord. Yep. One quick question on this slide. Approximately how many staff members are in each of those groups?
It varies from groups. Each group's a little bit different. We have 133 people in the engineering organization, with a high of about 40 people in our design engineering organization, and 27 in our program engineering organization. Typically, nominally about 33 people per organization.
Great, thank you.
Next slide, please. So we reorganized the engineering organization in August of 2020, and we had a couple of drivers for that reorganization. First was, as we approached the end of life of the power plant, and recognition that not only do we expect some individuals to be leaving through attrition, either retirement or looking for other positions within PG&E or elsewhere, we wanted to increase our cross-training between our engineers in order to ensure that we have proficiency with our decreasing staff size. We established a knowledge transfer program about 10 years ago in anticipation of loss of some of our engineering staff due to retirements, even before we decided that we were going to shut the plant down in 2024 and 2025. In addition, the engineering reorganization sets engineering up to better serve the needs of our internal customers, specifically tying the skill sets and the capabilities to our maintenance organization, and specifically our Fix-It-Now organization in maintenance. The changes that we made are based on industry guidance and recommendations over the last 3 years. Industry has identified a number of different initiatives in order to streamline the engineering organization, and again, to better align it to the way maintenance organizations were set up around the country. One of the big changes that we made was expanding the size of our engineering Fix-It-Now team. We call that EFIN. And we expanded that team to provide additional resources and more rapid response to any equipment challenges that came up in the power plant. We've increased the staff. We've got in our EFIN organization, we include civil engineers, mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, and INC engineers who have a broad skill set, including system knowledge as well as design change capability, that they can respond rapidly to issues that might come up in the power plant. And they work with our maintenance Fix-It-Now team in order to solve problems quickly in the power plant. In addition, we grouped all of our component experts into our tactical engineering organization to provide an additional layer of support for EFIN and rapid response to any challenges that may occur in the plant. Both EFIN and our component experts are all part of the tactical engineering organization. Next slide, please. We grouped our system engineers together in our strategic engineering organization to allow them to focus on system trending, system monitoring, and allow that group of engineers to focus on planning for maintaining reliable equipment through the rest of the life of the power plant. We combined our design engineering and project management groups together in anticipation of fewer major projects. We've gone from dozens of projects over the years down to only a handful at this point in time as we go forward. And then lastly, we took all of our major engineering programs and grouped them into our program engineering organization. And that allows for continued focus on those areas through the end of plant life. So many of these programs will be applicable all the way through shutdown of Unit 2. Even after we shut down Unit 1, we'll continue to need support for these major engineering programs. Next slide, please. So that's an overview of the engineering organization and the changes we've made at the end of 2020. We made these changes while working remotely, and we were very successful. To the bulk of the Diablo Canyon organization, it was, they were transparent changes that either did not impact or further promoted the ability of the rest of the plant to get work done. Wanted to briefly talk about some highlights from our 2020 excellence plan, and then I'll talk a little bit about our 2021 excellence plan highlights. So for 2020, first and foremost, we were focused on personnel safety. And one of the actions was to eliminate safety vulnerabilities with personnel working remotely. We've been working remotely now for almost a year, going on our second year now. And as we shifted to personnel working remotely, it was important that we make sure that people were set up in the remote environment to work safely. We signed all of our engineers up for ergonomic evaluations from their homes. We've provided engineers as needed based on those ergonomic evaluations, additional equipment to ensure that they can work from home safely. In addition, we did routine reinforcement of safety and human performance tools to our staff, particularly working remotely to make sure that people are adequately communicating, that they're looking out for their safety. It can be easy to be at home and think about, or to move out of the mindset that you're working in an office environment, even at home. So reinforced use of safety and human performance tools to our staff very successfully. For people, we successfully implemented our engineering organization, as I mentioned. As I mentioned also, we successfully implemented knowledge transfer plans in advance of retirements and departures. We've had knowledge transfer plans and a knowledge transfer committee in place for 10 years. And we've been very successful in assuring that we have adequate knowledge and proficiency in our engineering staff to continue to support all plant operations. And then lastly, under our people committees, we established a grassroots committee to identify ways to help the staff prepare for the end of life of the plant. Specifically to help the staff prepare for what they're going to be doing after the plant shuts down in 2025. Next slide, please. Under reliability, Unit 1 performance has been very good over the course of 2020, top of the industry for Unit 1 performance. And I think, as the committee is aware, we've had our challenges with the main generator on Unit 2, and that's really driven the overall performance on Unit 2 over the course of this year. Engineering has had a strong role in supporting resolution of the issues with the main generator. A hallmark of the engineering organization at Diablo Canyon is maintaining a strong technical conscience, and based on self-assessments that we continue to do, as well as numerous discussions with our staff, we continue to have a very strong technical conscience and an engineering staff that is advocating for driving continued safe and reliable operation of the facility. And then lastly, for 2020 affordability, we identified opportunities to reduce some of our Unit 1 refueling outage work without affecting safety or reliability. We took a look at a lot of the operating experience we had with all the activities that we're doing during a refueling outage to identify those where we have consistently seen good performance during testing or during maintenance. And in fact, elimination of some of these tests or some of these maintenance activities, as we've seen with some of our significant components like diesel generators, we actually found that when we over-maintain them or over-test them, we actually can have an adverse effect on reliability. So we took a look at our operating experience we had with doing testing and maintenance, and adjusted some of our testing and maintenance frequencies based on our experience. Next slide, please. So for 2021, similar categories, personnel safety. Continue to monitor the health and well-being of our staff as we move into our second year of working remotely. At this point in time, PG&E intends to have personnel that are capable of working remotely and continue to do so through at least July 6th. It's important that we, particularly as this pandemic has gone on and as people have been working remotely for a long time, that we stay connected and in touch with the people on our staff to make sure that they've got everything that they need in order to continue working remotely safely. Under our people goal area, we'll continue to implement the grassroots committee ideas to strengthen PG&E knowledge of DCPP personnel. One of the things that the committee identified is that in many cases, other parts of the company may not be aware of all of the capabilities of Diablo Canyon engineers. And conversely, we found that a lot of our Diablo Canyon engineering staff weren't aware of the opportunities within PG&E and other places. So we're continuing to strengthen that knowledge with communication out to the rest of the PG&E organization.
Hey, Pat?
Yes, sir.
Come in here. On that first bullet, personnel safety, you mentioned people will be working at home up until July the 6th. What's so special about that date?
That particular date is the date that the company has established at this point in time to do another review to see where we are with the pandemic and to see if we're in a position to be able to safely return people to working in an office environment.
Got it. Okay, thanks.
Mr. Nugent, this is Peter Lamb.
Yes, Dr. Lamb.
On that date of potential easing of the restriction on social distancing, isn't it also depending on what Governor Newsom may do regarding the executive order 2021?
Most definitely. And that's really a milestone date for us to reevaluate where we are as far as pandemic response in the state of California. So yes, it ties to Governor Newsom's direction as far as stay at home orders as well. That's one aspect of it that'll be evaluated at that point in time. We've established periodic reassessment points throughout the course of the pandemic to see where we are. We're not going to be bringing people back into an office environment until that meets state guidelines, and we are convinced that it is safe to do so.
Okay. And a second question. On the second bullet on people, would you be able to provide us with more example on what PG&E knowledge would include? I mean, what type of knowledge are you specifically thinking about strengthening? Is it the knowledge?
Yes. So really what I'm referring to is we've got Diablo Canyon Diablo Canyon personnel have a very specialized set of skills. And in some cases, with PG&E being a very broad organization, including gas transmission and distribution, including electric transmission and distribution, including the other parts of generation for PG&E, we have found that sometimes our engineers are not aware of some of the job opportunities in other parts of the company because they just don't have the background and knowledge of what all of the functions are in other lines of business within PG&E. So that's what I'm referring to by knowledge of PG&E knowledge of what's going on in other parts of PG&E.
Oh, I see. So you are primarily focusing on career opportunities for your people.
Absolutely.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Next slide, please. Under reliability, our objectives for 2021 are to maintain Unit 1 performance at top of industry and to resolve the Unit 2 main generator challenges. And our goal in order to supply reliable power to our customers, particularly during the summer months, is to assure that we have highly reliable units, both Units 1 and 2, during the summer months when the power is needed most by our customers. And in the reliability area, we will continue to maintain a strong technical conscience with our engineering staff. And then finally, as we look at affordability, to continue to identify process improvements to reduce time that's required for refueling outage equipment testing. We have found in comparing ourselves to other plants in the industry that some of our processes are not as efficient as they could be. We can make efficiency improvements in our testing processes in order to reduce time and overall impact on a refueling outage. And with that, that was the end of my prepared remarks, and I'll open up to any other questions the committee may have.
Pat, this is Rick McWhorter again. Your design engineering and project engineers, are they providing any support to the decommissioning organization at this time?
At this point in time, no. The decommissioning organization has a separate staff. We have not been providing any support to the decommissioning organization at this point.
Would you foresee as part of your people planning that that would be a way to help people transition to other jobs following the cessation of power of operations?
Yes, indeed. And that's one of the things that we keep in touch with the decommissioning organization to understand what kind of engineering support will be needed. That's still being worked out within the decommissioning organization. But fortunately, a lot of the decommissioning leadership staff came out of the engineering organization, is very familiar with the capabilities of our engineers, and looks forward to taking advantage of the capabilities of our engineering staff as applicable and as needed.
All right, thank you.
Pat Furman here. A couple questions. One, do you require or encourage or reward engineers getting a professional engineering license?
We definitely encourage our engineering staff to get professional engineering licenses. And some of the things we do to encourage them to do so is as part of our educational refund opportunities, we will pay for engineers to take classes to prepare for either the fundamentals of engineering exam or the professional engineering exam. And in addition, once the engineers have passed that test, we pay for the annual renewal fees for those licenses.
Right. Are there any positions that you need the license to qualify for?
We need to maintain a certain amount of professional engineering licenses in the various disciplines in order to review and approve designs and calculations, but we don't. And so we monitor the number of professional engineering licenses we have. However, I don't have a specific requirement for a new engineer coming into the organization to necessarily have an engineering license of some sort.
I guess I meant maybe some of the advanced engineering positions as you get up higher, requirement for a license.
No.
Okay.
No, there is no, there is not a requirement for a professional engineering license at the manager or director level.
All right. And I think I know the answer to this question, but are you hiring any new engineers at all?
We are. So we have run into situations where we've had engineers that have left for other parts of the company. We are backfilling many of those positions. And in some cases, those positions are coming from other places within PG&E or and within the generation organization. Or at times, we move engineers from within the engineering organization into a different position, and then we're able to capture a position elsewhere. We are not specifically hiring entry-level engineers right now, though that is not off the table. If the need arises, we still have contacts with some of the major engineering universities in the state in order to continue to pursue that if needed.
Okay. Final question. What are some examples of major projects or modifications that your design engineers are doing between now and 2025?
So some of the things we're working on right now, we're in the midst of replacing the computer system that allows us to operate a condensate polishing system, for example. Another example is we're replacing our plant air compressor system. In fact, that's an example of something we're just finishing up now and putting in service. Another example is replacing our oily water separator, which is a piece of our overall, essentially sewer system at the power plant. Right. So those are some examples of things that we've been working on and that we're currently working on.
All right, good. Thank you.
Committee members, remark on Mr. Nugent's presentation.
Pat, this is Bob Budnitz. You said something partway through the talk that I think might benefit from some elaboration. You pointed out that you're trying to streamline outages and other maintenance. Good for you. And that part of that was the observation that sometimes doing more maintenance is detrimental. Let me just provide an example. Let's suppose that I'm supposed to change the oil and do all that maintenance on my car every 12,000 miles, but I decide to do it every 4,000. The layperson would say, gee, isn't that better? I mean, never minding the cost and the inconvenience and all that other stuff. But I know that there are some circumstances in which too much maintenance can actually be detrimental. Can you explain to our lay audience why that observation is valid for at least some maintenance activities?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So as you mentioned, Dr. Budnitz, too much maintenance can actually be problematic. We can, in doing too much maintenance, we can, or testing, which is another aspect of what we've been looking at as part of streamlining of our refueling outages, we can actually cause additional wear on components by over-testing them. So, for example, 15 years ago, we used to test each of our diesel generators once a month. Now we rotate testing the diesel generators so that we're testing one diesel generator each month rather than testing all of them each month. And what we found was a significant improvement in our overall reliability of our diesel generators, not only from the perspective of increasing the availability of those diesel generators to respond in an emergency, but what we found is that we were causing excessive wear by testing them frequently. We were starting them from colder conditions, which caused additional wear. We also introduce, when we're doing maintenance more frequently, we introduce the possibility of introducing a problem into the component by doing the maintenance. We have strict human performance tools that we apply. We recognize, though, that we are human and that possibility could exist as well. Doing more maintenance is not always the best thing in order to support the piece of equipment.
Another scenario, there I am. There's another scenario that arises for certain kinds of equipment, and that is the principal issue with maintenance is one time in a million or one time in a thousand or whatever, it's you fail to restore it properly. And sometimes that failure to restore is the principal mechanism. Everything else works fine. And obviously, if you're going to do a lot more maintenance, there introduces more possibility of a failure to restore properly. And that's another example of too much isn't always better.
I mean, and that's correct. And that's,
it depends on what you're doing.
That's right. And that's what I was referring to, but with my comment on human performance is we can sometimes restore a piece of equipment incorrectly. The other thing that we can run into by doing more maintenance is we can introduce a new part into a system, replacing an existing part as part of the maintenance activity. And we can actually put a part in that, although it's brand new, it experiences what we call infant mortality. There is some probability of just as part of manufacturing processes that a part will fail much sooner than its expected life. And so we can take a part that is reliable and potentially introduce a part that is not as reliable.
Yeah, and you also pointed out earlier that sometimes the maintenance causes wear and tear, which causes more trouble than the maintenance improvements are worth.
That's correct.
I mean, by the way, everybody at home will understand my domestic example. I don't know what you do at home, but we wash our sheets once a week. But, you know, you'd say, isn't it cleaner to wash them every day? Well, yeah, except it wears the sheets out. Now, you know,
that's right.
Which isn't a big deal for us, but we don't do that. And people understand. But for a major piece of equipment, maybe that's not the right thing. Right?
That's absolutely right, Dr. Butness.
I mean, you know, that analogy isn't exact, but it's sort of the idea. There's an optimum, and you try to have to strive to learn what it is.
Dr. Butness, that's exactly right. But when I was a college student, I don't remember washing the sheets.
Oh boy, I can't deal with you.
Okay, any additional committee members or technical consultants' comments on Mr. Nugent's excellent presentation, Dr. Peterson? Nope. There being no committee members' comments, let us entertain public comments. Committee counsel, Mr. Rahi. Your mic is mute, Mr. Rahi.
I do have one comment from Ms. Lewis.
Hi, Sherry Lewis from Mothers for Peace. And I want to comment on a few pages back that had reliability and three dots and then affordability and one dot. And I want to talk about affordability. And it says here, identified opportunities to reduce Unit 1 refueling outage work without affecting safety or reliability. And I was wondering if one of the opportunities to reduce refueling outage work had to do with when it was being considered about transferring a lot of fuel rods from the spent fuel pools into the casks, either as soon as they could be or holding off until the end and doing it all in one fell swoop. And I believe that's an example because I know PG&E wanted to wait. And then in that case, the spent fuel pool was piling up with a lot of fuel rods. And that would be saving money for PG&E because the transfer could all be done at once at the end. But that was, though saving money, it's not as safe to have a lot of fuel, to have the spent fuel pools packed so tightly. So I just wanted to make that comment, kind of referring to what David Weissman was saying about PG&E sometimes choosing cost over safety. That's what I wanted to say.
All
Thank you, Ms. Lewis, for your remark.
And I do have a comment from Mr. Wiseman.
It's not as much a comment as a question, and I appreciate, Mr. Rathi, as you said, your website is under redesign. But it was mentioned earlier that the PowerPoints that we've seen today are downloadable. And it used to be on the old website, there was the current meeting and the information packets. Can't seem to find it at the redesigned website.
I think something has changed on the website from yesterday to today, and I've sent an email to our webmaster, but I will send you those PowerPoints.
Thank you very much.
I can do that right now.
Okay, thank you.
If there's anybody else amongst the public that wants them, pipe up now, and we can send them to you too.
Sure thing.
Thank you.
You also have, looks like Tom Murray's hand is up.
Okay, let me get to Tom Murray here. Okay. Mr. Murray.
Yeah, can you hear me?
We can.
Thank you. Director Nugent, several times you refer to the engineering group that is going to be working on or overseeing decommissioning. Is that group part of PG&E? Or is it something that is being outsourced? Pat, you're on.
Okay. In regards to that question, can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Okay, good. The decommissioning organization that we have in place right now is part of PG&E. It's part of the overall generation organization within PG&E.
You used the word right now in your statement, just now.
Yeah.
Would you like to develop that a little bit more?
I don't, for the long term, I don't know where we're headed with decommissioning. It's not an area that I'm involved with on a day-to-day basis. I know there's lots of different plants that have taken different approaches on decommissioning. I do not know where we are headed with decommissioning Diablo Canyon at this point.
It sounds like you're saying that using an outsource group is on the table, but not necessarily a decision at this moment.
Like I said, there's lots of different considerations going on based on experience in other parts of the industry, and a decision has not been made yet.
Thank you for your illuminating this.
If I may provide some context to Mr. Murray's inquiry, the federal regulations allow a 60 years time period for the licensee to complete its task on decommissioning. And I repeat, it's 60 years, 60. So within that time frame, the licensee had a lot of discretion and a lot of choices to make. I hope that adds some content to Mr. Nugent's remark. Okay, committee counsel, Mr. Rahi, are there any additional public comments?
Being none.
There being none, let us give our thanks to Mr. Nugent for a very informative presentation and go to the next most important item on our agenda, which is concluding remarks by committee members. Dr. Butness and Dr. Peterson, your concluding remarks, please.
No remarks for me.
I just want to say I'm hoping that we can actually get together in person in June, but I'm not holding my breath. Our public meeting is in the last week in June.
I think we decided that we will not attempt to have an in-person meeting.
Yeah, I'm not going to argue that. Let's suppose, I'm holding my breath now. Let's suppose that all of a sudden in the next couple of months, things look way better. And it could, things could be lifted, but I'm hoping, but I'm not holding my breath.
Yeah, we, as I think I mentioned yesterday, we do have a reservation at Avila Lighthouse Suites for the June meeting at this point. So we're still holding that. We've been holding them all the way through just in case something changed, but we would be prepared if we had to hold the meeting in person.
Sounds good.
Is there any procedural or administrative matter?
Mr. I just Lonnie? Wonder whether Hector Garcia has had any feedback. I'm putting him on the spot, but it was only yesterday, about the dates and the new dates and stuff that we tentatively were discussing when we were doing calendar work yesterday. If not, you know, it's only just been 24 hours and maybe we'll hear later.
Right.
Mr. Budnitz, Shane Guest here. I'll be taking that back to Hector. I'll be covering for him today.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I mean, you understand. We set some dates for some meetings in the future, and his assignment is to assure that there's nothing on PG&E's end that would conflict that we'd need to know about. You know, it's not, I didn't expect that there would necessarily be any response by now. It's fair enough.
Thanks. I'll follow up with him.
Now, there being no additional pending matters before the committee, on behalf of the committee, let me say thank you to Director Tom Baldwin, Business Operations, for his very helpful help to the committee in making sure this public meeting is conducted successfully, and also with his management team, all the changes made by committee's counsel at the very last minute. Thank you very much. And on behalf of the committee, also thank all the participants to this successful 98th public meeting of the Abel County Independent Safety Committee, and to the video team that had provided technical support. Did I forget anybody, committee counsel, Mr. Rahi?
I think the only thing I'd also like to express that Mr. Garcia, he was instrumental in making this meeting run as well as it did. And I'd just like to mention, just for the record, that our next meeting is scheduled for June 23rd and 24th of this year.
Great, great. With that remark, thank you, everybody, and see you the next time. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you.